Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of Between the Sheets. So, and along with David Bixenspan, my co-host, we are joined tonight by Joe Gagne, who had one of the best wrestling-related podcasts of a bygone era, it seems like now, Joe, and Joe versus the World. But now he does the great wrestling podcast thread on Voices of Wrestling and has the Fun Time Arcade podcast. Joe, how's it going, man?
Doing okay. Just, I mean, you might want to speak to the circumstances we're recording this.
Yeah, exactly. We're recording right now at 7:25 p.m. Friday night Eastern Time, and it's been about an hour since the news that Roddy Piper passed away in his sleep after a heart attack at the age of 61, and it's pretty shocking, you know. I had just woke up from a nap, got on Twitter, and saw that, and just like my jaw dropped. I mean, this is a guy that all three of us grew up with, one of the biggest stars in the history of the business, and it's just wow. Biggs, quickly, what give your thoughts about the legacy of Piper?
He's a guy that's so many. People of so many different ages grew up with. I mean, you think about it. I mean, he was a star, regional star, starting, what, 77 in Los Angeles?
Late 76 into 77s, where he first, you know, became a name.
In Los Angeles, yeah.
Yeah.
So then Los Angeles went out nationally and was big, especially in New York. Then goes to Portland in, what, late 78, early 79? And
He worked San Francisco, too.
All right, San Francisco, too. Goes to Portland, then, you know, goes to Crockett, and then Crockett for a few years, and Georgia, and then goes to WWF, and then eventually, you know, he's off for a few years making movies, then he's in WCW. I mean, WCW through pretty much almost the end, then comes back to WWF a few times for different things. I mean, really, I mean, the WCW stuff, I mean, excuse me, the later WWF stuff, not as much, but really, from any point from, like, the mid-70s, people who grew up, were kids from like the mid 70s through the late 90s would have grown up on it. I mean, even Hogan had maybe a more relevant 2000s period, but you know what I mean? I mean, hard pressed to find really anyone else that was around longer of recent, you know, generations.
Yeah, maybe Flair and stuff like that, Dusty, but that was about the peak of it, because the other guys were, you know, in and out or gone completely by that time period. But Joe, Piper is a guy who is known just as much for his career outside of the ring. You know, they live as people always talk about the fight scene, and they live with Keith David and, you know, other stuff he did outside of wrestling. Talk about Piper's impact on pop culture.
Oh, They Live is one of the consummate wrestler appearances in movies when that wasn't really a thing at the time. And the fight scene in that, the catchphrase, you know, I'm all out of bubble gum. And just, he was a guy that really just went beyond wrestling. Like, he's someone, you know, like my mom knew about, and she, you know, certainly didn't watch wrestling, but she was aware of him and all he did. And that's kind of the impact he would have. And just, you know, the things he pioneered, the heel commentary role, the interview segment that, you know, there've been dozens and dozens of duplicators, and it still goes on today, and that's something he was a part of, and such a huge part of the boom period, the foil for Hogan. You know, you look at the war to settle the score, WrestleMania 1, just how important he was, like, really one of the most important people in company history, if you think about it.
Without Piper, there probably is no WrestleMania, and there is no World Wrestling Federation as we know it. I mean, it takes two to tango, and Piper was the perfect foil for Hulk Hogan. I mean, his impact on MTV in that era was huge, working in the Rock and Wrestling deal, the angle where he broke the gold record over Lou Albano's head. I mean, he had monstrous heat, and he carried the ball, you know, because he was so believable in his promos. I mean, you believe the guy was generally nuts. And I say, that's one thing about Piper is he never changed. He always was Roddy Piper, whether he was heel or babyface. He always had that charisma about him, you know, chaotic, You know, you just didn't know what was going to come out of his mouth, good or bad. And it's just like I said, it's just a shock that this happened. And it's kind of interesting because the week we are covering tonight is July 27th through August 3rd, 1990, which was a big week in the life of Roddy Piper, because we're going to start off in the World Wrestling Federation. And the big news story of this week is Jesse the Body Ventura has left the WWF after his contract expired. And he went on a Ron Barr show on Sports Byline USA. Yeah, it was around back then too. And he said that he wasn't coming back. And the main sticking point was there was a situation between warring video game company factions where Vince McMahon, of course, was linked to with Acclaim, who was licensed to Nintendo. And Jesse was working on a video game with DreamWorks, who is a fledgling company at this time. And they were aligned with Sega, which Sega Genesis was going to be debuting pretty soon. And as part of the contract deal, Vince was like, I don't want you working for this, you know, these rival companies. And Jesse wouldn't back down. Of course, you know, that's how Jesse is. And just and both of them wouldn't budge, and the contract expired. And Jesse eventually left and took a deal working with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers as a color guy for NFL for 1 year. And I remember watching the NFL films. They always did team highlights after the seasons. And I remember watching the 1990 Tampa Bay Bucs film, and they always would use the radio announcers. You know, to go over the highlights. And I heard Jesse's voice. I'm like, wait a minute. And I was like, wow, he's working with Gene Deckerhoff, who's a legendary play-by-play man in Florida State, Tampa. And I was like, and as it went on, whenever they would play a Jesse soundbite, I mean, he was Jesse Ventura just an NFL version. You know, he would still do his quips and stuff. And it only lasted 1 year. But, anyway, the guy that was hired to replace Jesse Ventura was Roddy Piper.
Who was already around as a wrestler at that point.
Who was already there as a wrestler, but, you know, he's now kind of phasing out of active wrestling. And, he would come back. But he becomes the main announcer on the Superstars and pay-per-views and Saturday Night Main Event. And, which it was ironic, though, because he was working on a television series called Tag Team on ABC with Jesse the Body Ventura. But another funny thing about this was that one of the other guys they were negotiating with was a young guy named Diamond Dallas Page. So that's another interesting what if. But Joe, Ventura, Piper.
Actually, you know what? I have to jump in for a second just to point out that we'll actually be talking more about DDP and DDP announcing later.
Yeah, exactly. But Ventura and Piper, that's kind of a culture shock in announcing, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it was. What was frustrating about being a fan at that time is you turned on Superstars and Roddy Piper was doing commentary, and you're like, where's Jesse? Because, you know, he had been there for years and years. He called the first six WrestleManias and all the pay-per-views, and all of a sudden, 1 week, he's just gone, never to return. And Piper, for me, was always a bit too manic. He didn't take over the heel role. It was more of a face dynamic with Vince McMahon. It was never quite the same. Something was always lost. He wasn't bad. I remember he did SummerSlam that year with Gorilla Monsoon. He did okay. And it just wasn't the same. And I mean, if this happened now, we would know ahead of time that, you know, hey, there's going to be a new commentary. But I remember at the time that, you know, like, what the hell's going on?
It was like Ventura disappeared and there was no mention of him or anything. And then by Piper was at first, and SummerSlam is a show. He did have like tweener deals going on, where especially like towards Hogan, where, you know, he would kind of take shots at Hogan and some of the other baby faces, but like it wasn't over the top. And then of course he became full blown babyface, and then they added Savage to the fold the next year. But Bix, Piper as, you know, an announcer. Yeah, totally. Just as was Piper as we know him. I mean, just everywhere, off the wall.
Right. He was not the Georgia Championship Wrestling Piper as an announcer.
No, and we already had known how good he could be in that role. you know, working from in Georgia, but, you know, Gordon Solie and Vince McMahon are two totally different beasts as announcers too. But yeah, it's just, it was a big, big shift in the paradigm of the promotion, where, and basically, you know, Heenan would become the force as 91 grew on the big shows and with Gorilla and stuff like that. But
although it was weird though, because I don't think they ever moved Heenan to Superstars, did they?
No, he always stayed on Challenge. Vince worked with Piper and Savage, and I think it was just exclusively Savage.
There was the thing with Honky Tonk Man. When was that?
Oh, man.
That was post-Piper leaving?
Yeah, for a short time.
I think Neidhart was on Challenge around that time, which didn't last long because he was awful. But
yeah, the steady announcing was not there anymore, you know, for a while, other than Gorilla and Heenan. And it just it made for a different vibe in the company. Which they were going through changes at that time anyway. The days of, you know, the rock and wrestling era were leaving, and a new scene was coming on.
Perhaps even a new generation.
Not there yet.
Basically,
a bunch of guys who were.
I had to say it though.
80 stars coming in, which we'll talk about in a minute. But first, before we get there, there's a legal problem, which, again, you know, the last show we talked about Jake the Snake Roberts' legal issues. Well, Mr. Perfect returned to action on July 27th in Hamilton, Ontario, after missing some time due to receiving 21 stitches in his head after a brawl at Pop Saloon, which sounds like quite a nice place to go to, in Fawcett, Illinois, at 3:45 in the morning on July 17th. Bar patron James Bishop had gotten into it with Perfect, Haku, and Brady Boone over a woman they were talking to, and Haku kicked the shit out of everyone, which what a shock that is, including biting a chunk out of a 6'6", 280-pound former boxer-turned-police officer who said that he had never been manhandled like that before. Haku took on over 6 cops and bouncers until one of them clocked him over the head with a nightstick the size of a baseball bat. It didn't knock him out, but it dazed him enough to get him cuffed. Haku was arrested for battery, resisting arrest, and damaging property. Joe, that's a very believable scenario I just said right there, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't blink when you read that.
It goes to the myth of Haku being one of the baddest dudes in the history of wrestling. I mean, the stories about him are legendary. And just the fact that it was Haku, Perfect, and Brady Boone, that's quite the trio there, Bix.
Was this in Minnesota?
It was in Illinois.
Or was that, I'm trying to figure out, is there an area that borders on here? I don't know, because I'm thinking of...
If it was bordering somewhere, probably Wisconsin. I'm not sure where Sauce it is.
But go ahead.
But they were in Pop Saloon at 3:45 in the morning, for God's sake.
You know what, just hearing that story made me think of, though, was, you know, in Brett's book when he's talking about Haku, he's explaining who Haku is, and he's like blah 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 and something something bit a guy's nose off. Andre loved Haku.
Yeah, Haku, I mean, like I said, there's just the stories that guy are legendary. And you know, he just worked the very first show in my town promoted by Doc Gallows a few months ago, and he's, you know, older now and a little bit fatter, I guess you could say, but the way he was throwing chair shots and the way he was throwing, you know, strikes, I still would not mess with that dude. I mean, he could still cripple you to the day, you know. It's just insane how that the aura that he has as being a tough guy. And speaking of him, he, along with Bad News Brown, who at this time started being phased out in a way, they were offered contracts from All Japan and New Japan, respectively. And Haku's contract was going to be set up where he was going to be Jumbo's tag team partner in the end of 1990 in the Real World Tag League. And they were going to bring him in that way. And for people who don't know, Haku was an All Japan trainee years ago. He worked in the dojos in the late 70s. And Bad News, of course, has, you know, many New Japan tours under his belt.
They broke him into New Japan.
Didn't
Haku
they?
Didn't All Japan break Barbarian in with Haku, too?
Not the same time period.
But weren't they both Barbarian sumo? Joe. They were both sumos, right? From Tonga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Haku in Japan, because he stayed and he became basically a low card, or I mean, a low mid card. But if he would have went Japan, could you imagine like the matches he would have had team with Jumbo against Masao and Kawada?
That's an interesting what if, because I don't remember a lot that he did in the WWF after this time frame. Like,
well, when he went to SWS, was that through WWF? Because he was pretty much full time there.
Yeah, that was through the WWF deal.
Okay, because you know what though, when he teamed with Jumbo at the the Wrestling Summit, that was a really good match.
Yeah,
it was him and Jumbo against who was it, Martel and Hennig?
Yes, and that had some pretty good chemistry there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, just Haku and Misawa and Kawada, man, and Kobashi. I mean, Jesus. I mean, that's just again more great what ifs. And of course, Bad News did go back. His last match, of course, would be SummerSlam, I think. He may have worked some house shows after that.
But he didn't go to All Japan. He went back to New Japan.
He went back to New Japan for a little bit, and
then bounced
around after that went global and stuff like that. But yeah, one of those what ifs regarding wrestling. Also, on July 27th, young Nicholas Hogan was brought into the world by Terry and Linda, and.
I mean, I have a joke I want to make about this, but I'm worried that people who hear what I'm trying to say wrong, if you've read the news the last couple days before we recorded this.
Yeah, and this was during Hogan's break period between, after the earthquake angle, so I guess it was good timing that happened. But, just noting that he was born on July 27, 1990.
I wonder if all the cards and letters were in his baby book. Did Tugboat, maybe Tugboat saved them for himself.
Yeah. On television that weekend, we had the debut of Power and Glory, managed by Slick, Hercules and Paul Roma. Now, these guys were languishing around this time period, low-carb guys. Hercules was a miscast babyface. Paul Roma was Paul Roma. But when they got together, they were a pretty fun tag team, I thought. Maybe not as great in the ring, But Joe, I thought that they were effective in their roles.
I will never understand what happened, because they teamed up. They had their awesome finisher. Cool name. They had the win against the Rockers at SummerSlam. They had a big push at Survivor Series. They were programmed with the Hart Foundation on the road. And then you would think that would lead to a title match at WrestleMania 7. That went to the Nasty Boys. Power and Glory got squashed in a minute by the road by Legion of Doom. They got programmed with the Bushwhackers on the road, lost that SummerSlam that year in a 6-man tag, and then were basically broken up. So I don't know whether this is the ultimate case of Vince losing interest or something happened, but it was just such a strange turn.
Yeah, it was. And Bix, Paul Roma's a heel, was a perfect fit for his character. He was awesome in this role. He was awesome as Pretty Paul Roma and Pretty Wonderful. But yeah, I mean, he's a guy that was totally miscast the babyface.
Yeah, I mean, I like Power and Glory. I mean, I'm trying to think if they're a match, but they didn't really get many opportunities to have good matches. Like, I'm trying to think, did any matches with the Rockers show up, like, on any garden shows?
Well, they had the SummerSlam.
SummerSlam, that's another one, I remember.
And yeah. The SummerSlam match, that was the one where there was the knee injury from Michaels.
And that's a good match while it lasts. And
yeah,
aren't they in the Survivor Series match with the Rockers that year?
Yes, they were on the Visionaries.
That's a really good match. I remember, people don't talk about that, but that's a very good match. Who is it? It's the Martel, Warlord, Power and Glory against Jake, Rockers, and Snuka?
Jimmy Snuka.
Yeah, that's a very good match. And they're part of why. So, I mean, I just think if they had gotten more high-profile matches with the Rockers and stuff, then maybe we would be talking about them having more good matches, because Roma finally found something that fit him as a heel. Hercules was not what he was in the mid-80s, but he was better than he had been in a while. So I think, and right, just as a team, they fit. I mean, they just went really well together, had a good, interesting image and the outfits and everything. So, yeah. I mean, and of course, their finisher. We didn't talk about their finisher.
Joe did.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. I said it was really cool. That's about it.
Well, it's the Powerplex, yes.
The Powerplex, where, was it Hercules hit the Superplex and
Roma did the splash?
Did the splash on top rope. And they had really good timing.
Yes, even though Art Barr had the better splash, they actually did it much better than Los Gringos Lopez did.
Yeah. They had one of the coolest finishers of that era in tag team. And, you know, there's some tag teams today that don't have a double team finisher that probably should use that as a finisher. But moving on. Also in that episode of Superstars, there was the announcement of Jake the Snake Roberts against Bad News Brown in a special Harlem sewer rat match with Big Boss Man as referee. Now, so
why did Bad News leave again?
Yeah, well, Bad News had just come off the WrestleMania deal with Piper, God rest his soul, who was dressed half black, painted half black, and now he's gone into this situation. Biggs, describe the Harlem sewer rats.
So let's see. They were. I don't think they ever showed them. I think it was just Bad News carrying around a cage that had like black garbage bags stretched around.
Yeah, that's the deal. They never showed them. Yeah, you never saw them. And even on that match, they never come out. And basically, what the deal was, and Joe was, they were supposed to eat the snake. And then the snake shows up
because snakes never eat rats.
Yeah, the Jake pulled the snake out, but of course you never see the rats.
Yeah, I remember it would also shake. The cage would shake violently when Bad News was doing a promo, just a ridiculous amount. Like, and he also bragged he hadn't fed them in weeks, and I'm like, well, I don't think they're gonna be. I don't know much about rats, but I don't think they can go weeks without eating.
Yeah, but, it was just the weirdest thing, and. I think he said they were like 2,000 pounds of rats in the cage, which
he wouldn't be able to. Are you sure he didn't say 200?
No, it said it was 2,000. It was over exaggeration. What'd you expect? You know, what do you expect from WWF? You know, it's over exaggeration.
Anything can happen in the World Wrestling Federation.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, Saturday night's main event airs that Saturday night. And
so it was Jesse's voice was still on all these, right?
This was the last appearance of Jesse Mighty Ventura on television, I guess you could say. And it was the Wild Kingdom themed.
Yes.
Sorry, that's a minute. And I'm trying to remember, was this the very first of those themes they did? Because they eventually would do more.
Yeah, they did Oktoberfest later. This is the first one. I can't remember the Safari one. Thankfully, they didn't shoot a lion because that gets you in a lot of trouble these days.
Oh, of course, yeah. God forbid. Could you imagine if Mean Gene was out there blasting a lion? So anyway.
Bad choice of words. You just gave me a very bad mental.
Yeah. So anyway.
That was an uncomfortable silence, and justifiably so.
So going over the matches of the show, we had Ultimate Warrior defeating Rick Rude by DQ when Heenan interfered, and then Warrior beat Heenan up, which when Heenan could still take bumps. We had Demolition, Smash, and Crush with Axe and Ringside being the Rockers. And the Hart Foundation and Legion of Doom shows up to dispute the decision because Axe got involved, of course. We had Mr. Perfect beating Tito Santana, which that match actually made the Best of Saturday Night's Main Event DVD. For some interesting reason.
Well, it's actually a very good match if you go back and watch it.
It is.
That as a kid, like, whoa, this is more exciting than your normal match. Not that I had concepts of work rate or anything like that. I'm just like, oh, this is very exciting to watch.
Yeah. And then we had Kerry Von Erich making his television debut, defeating a very fat Playboy Buddy Rose in a match that was supposed to be Rick Martel, who was injured at the time, and Brutus the Barber Beefcake, who had had his parasailing accident just right before the taping.
That shows just how long feuds got dragged out back then. The feud that barely anyone remembers, like why did I say Piper? I guess I know why I said Piper, but Martel versus Beefcake, which started at the beginning of January, lasted into July, or the tapings for July.
Yeah.
When that's a feud almost nobody remembers.
Yeah, and mid-card feuds would go that way. I mean, that was just wrestling. And then they had a deal where Vince interviewed Hogan in the ring. He made his return. He got a huge reaction on this show. And, you know, thanked everyone for supporting him after her earthquake attacked him. Then, of course, Earthquake, Dino Bravo, and Jimmy Hart show up, have Hogan cornered. Then Tugboat runs out, running literally, and joined Hogan in the ring, made to say, blah, blah, blah. Joe, I went over all the matches, but I think maybe the most memorable aspect of this show were the hilarious skits where Mean Gene and Lord Alfred Hayes are doing their version of Wild Kingdom, where Lord Alfred Hayes fully believes he's Marlon Perkins.
he got into it a la Fuji Vice. These were I could watch really Mean Gene, an underrated comedic performer. I could watch him in any kind of a skit like this. But this was pretty funny if you go back and watch it.
And regarding the matches on the show, what stood out from the show other than Perfect and Tito?
I found it odd, like at the time, that they ran the SummerSlam main event before on a Saturday Night.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was to set it up being in a cage, but still, that was not the pattern we were used to. It was programs that were at the end of their house show run.
Yeah, this was something that we see now, and they were doing it back then. You know, we complain about now how Raw runs the pay-per-view main events on Raw.
Yeah, they just did this week.
Yeah, exactly. And now you have it on SmackDown. I mean, not SmackDown, on Saturday Night's main event. It happened in 1990. So, yes, it did happen in this era, folks. This is nothing new. But Bix, this show did a 7.2 rating at the time period, which was pretty strong for, 11:30 to, 1 a.m. slot.
But down a lot from a few years earlier.
Yeah, it was down from a few years earlier. And Saturday Night Live at this time was really starting to catch on again. So the frequency of Saturday Night's main events were starting to get lower. But, talk about the deal with Kerry Von Erich and Buddy Rose.
I don't remember that much about in terms of what, though. I'm not sure what you're asking.
As far as, like, the seeing Kerry on WF television.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was weird. I mean, it was, because I'm trying to remember, like, because there was the thing where he no-showed the WCW taping right before this, but what was his last USWA date before this?
The week before.
So, yeah, I mean, if you're watching the syndicated TV, he was still on TV, and was probably still on TV for another week or so. So, I mean, you didn't usually see stuff like this happen. I mean, I guess with Tony Atlas, who also showed up around this week, I think this week, that's someone else who, I guess, because of the ICW stuff, was sort of showing up off of another promotion's TV. But obviously this was a much bigger deal because it was USWA. Well, I guess both were technically nationally syndicated, but it was very weird. And, of course, at first he was still Kerry Von Erich. He was the Texas Tornado Kerry Von Erich, but he was still Kerry Von Erich. And I'm trying to – did Vince acknowledge much of his history?
No. Okay. Basically, they called him was Texas Tornado.
They called him Texas Tornado Kerry Von Erich at first.
I don't think they did on the show.
On this show, they didn't, but they did what? On syndication, they did?
Yeah, I remember them, like.
I know they called him Kerry Von Erich, yes.
They worked their way into doing it, yeah, but I think
it was like it was your Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig type thing. Yeah.
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 It soon went away, and he was just the Texas Tornado.
And, yeah, and the Friday night
I did want to finish by saying, like, but you know what, though? It wasn't that out of the ordinary, because I was still pretty young, and, like, if you're seeing, because I don't remember what I was watching, whether it was ESPN or syndication with USWA at that point, but it was not out of the ordinary, like, for you to watch a USWA show, not know how recent it was, and then see someone on a WWF or WCW show. So it probably wasn't that weird, now that I think back about it, at least for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because you would have, what it was so weird was that by this point, the stuff they were running was pretty recent, like on the Legends of Wrestling shows. So, like, you could see, like, hey, it's Michael Hayes as a babyface, and it doesn't look like this is from that long a time ago. So, but you have to remember, I was young.
And in fact, it's just Kerry Von Erich working in WWF.
And just that, I mean, that was just.
Right,
because you wouldn't expect him. You're right. If you're going to expect him to show up anywhere, you expect WCW, probably.
I mean, you look at this time period, you have Kerry Von Erich, Sergeant Slaughter, and Legion of Doom coming in WWF.
And Tony Atlas.
And Tony Atlas, who made his debut on August 3rd in Dallas. Now, he of course, will become Saba Simba, but he worked this show as a babyface. But Joe, I mean, it's like, you know, we're in 1990, and they're bringing back the stars of 1984 again. And this comes off like, you know, WCW would bring in all the WWF guys, you know, in 94, 95 when Hogan was there. I mean, in an era where you really need to start trying to push your younger talent, they were going with older names.
That's true. Although, as a fan at the time, I didn't really, you know, that wasn't my mindset. They were all,
well, yeah, we were young,
fairly new guys to me. But you look back in retrospect, it was probably not a good business plan. But I was just like, hey, cool, a new guy. And he does a spinning punch, which I thought was a lame finisher, so I wasn't that into him.
It was cool for us, I guess, to see these guys on that stage.
Yeah.
You know, in a different deal. And they were fresh when they first came in, of course. And then, of course, you know, as it went along, they got stale like everybody else did. But, yeah, it's just an interesting deal that they were doing was they were bringing back older names. And saying more on television, on July 27th, that Friday, Rick Rude, Mr. Perfect, and Bobby Heenan were on Friday Night Videos on NBC.
That happened regularly back then, or at least for a few a few times it did.
Now, how old were you in this this era here?
Me or Jeff?
You.
So I was still not 6 years old yet, so I would not have seen Friday Night Videos, because that was a late night show, right?
Friday Night Videos lasted until the mid-90s, which was weird, but back in this era, I'm sure Joe remembers this, that, you know, you had Friday Night Videos on NBC, you had Night Tracks on TBS, and this is for people that didn't have MTV. You know, there were still a lot of people that didn't have cable television.
But there were a decent number of markets still that didn't have MTV. Not a ton, but enough.
So this was a way for you to see your favorite music videos. And of course, with the tie-in with NBC, you know, they would have, you know, WWF guys on there on occasion. But yeah, just one of those relics in time, you know, where you were watching NBC and TBS to find your favorite music videos. And that night, Rick Rude did a shot on Arsenio Hall, too, which...
I think that's on YouTube, right?
Yeah, he wore a leopard tracksuit. That's amazing. So yeah, worth it watching for that.
Yeah, Rick Rude was awesome on that show because he was Rick Rude all the way.
And, really? All the Arsenio spots with wrestlers are good.
And yeah, and it's the second straight week we've talked about wrestlers on Arsenio. So it was quite fitting. Now in the more business-related WF news, they lose their television slot on KTVU in San Francisco. And but the reason why is they decided to quit paying their weekly fee and for carrying the show, which is what, you know, way it was going back then. You paid for television.
Well, they also gave a percentage of the gate, though.
And percentage of the local house show gate. So, of course, NWA sees this and sweeps right on in.
Because that's a great TV station to be at.
Yeah. It's a very, very, very strong station. They give them $182,000 a year, which was $3,500 a week. Plus 10% of the gate of the grosses when they come to the Bay Area. Vix, describe that type of setup of, you know, the syndicated wrestling in that area and how that works.
I mean, it was not too uncommon to have that type of deal in major markets. I mean, the best known one, I think, is when Vince went into St. Louis, that was the type of deal that he went to KPLR with to get wrestling at the Chase. Although I believe that KPLR also had a similar arrangement with the local office before that. But so that was not uncommon. And then, you know, syndication, I mean, you had to fight for those prime slots in the big markets. I mean, is that kind of what you were asking me, or was there something else?
Yeah. It was a deal where the more money you paid, the better chance you had to get on the air.
Right. It depended on which stations were receptive to wrestling and all sorts of stuff and what time slots you could get, you know, like in, you know, you're in New York back then. The syndication for, you know, WWF was Saturday mornings at first at 10 a.m. And then around this time it got before this it got moved to noon, I think, for Superstars. Sundays at noon was Challenge. And then Spotlight was different times, like kind of floating around on MSG Network. And, you know, obviously not that MSG Network's a prime slot. I was just throwing it in there. And Crockett? WCW was on the CBS station, which is a stronger station, but they were on Saturday nights at 12:05 a.m. Which, yeah, I mean, I guess Saturday at 12:05 is not terrible, but far inferior time slot, especially to get kids and all that. Although, actually, no. Wait, you know what? No, they were still, excuse me, they were still on WPIX at this point. I'm sorry. So they were still on, so they actually, yes, WCW actually had an excellent time slot at this point. But that would change, like, about 6 months to a year later, I think.
Yeah.
Just for example, and, then they'd switch to, right, to Channel 2 at 12:05 a.m.
Yeah, Joe, the process of, you know, the way it was back in the day where the stations paid the wrestling promotions for the TV time totally changed when Vince started paying the stations to cover his wrestling. And that was like one of the big death blows in the territories.
Sure. If you're a TV station, would you rather pay out money or get paid for something? So.
Exactly. It makes total sense.
Well, it was because infomercials had become legal. So not only could you do that, but infomercials are competing with you anyway. Like, an infomercial might be more attractive than a barter deal.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was interesting business.
And when I say infomercial in that sense, I mean actual infomercials.
Yeah, Ron Popeil.
Yeah.
So if infomercials were not made legal,
no infomercials, I think that I think things would have been somewhat different, certainly. Huh. Yeah, if the laws hadn't changed.
Yeah. And this weekend, going in more business, they had a very successful run in Los Angeles and Oakland of house shows where they drew 11,700 in L.A. with a $176,000 gate, which was the second biggest one of the year behind the Mania show. And it did on 720 in Oakland, they drew 12,000, did 147,000. And this is Warrior and Rick Rude as the main events. And we always got the, you know, the vibe from different newsletters that Warrior wasn't a draw. The Warrior Rude feud didn't draw. Well, Joe, I think this right here proves that it did draw, at least in these big markets.
Yeah, I have no idea if it was just these dates or what. But, I mean, you know, you always heard, oh, Rude didn't draw because Warrior had beaten him previously. But, I mean, these are really huge gates and attendances, which jumped out at me.
And also when they say second biggest gate behind WrestleMania that year, that's the Skydome WrestleMania. I mean, that which yeah. did – it was over a million Canadian, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And then you look at the cards. All right, I'll go over the cards. And this tells you that this is all Warrior Rude. All right, you have Black Bart and Shane Douglas. Hercules against Jim Powers, which is funny because Paul Roman's from a foreigner. Jimmy Snuka and the Barbarian. Your semi-main event was Jake the Snake against Bad News. Then you had Nikolai Volkoff and Boris Zukov and the Rockers and Orient Express. That's the rest of the shows. So that's totally on Warrior and Rude.
When Boris Zukov's facing a name guy, you know that they're not loading up the undercard.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's just it totally goes against some of the stuff we've heard over the years. Also around this time period, the Pro Wrestling Torch reported that WWF is heavily scouting a guy named Mean Mark Callis, who was just lost to Lex Luger at the Grand American Bash Review for the United States Heavyweight title, was now like doing jobs on house shows in 30 seconds to various people, which is hilarious to think about how this guy went from me, Mark Callis, in July to becoming The Undertaker.
And he was a Survivor Series. It's not like he was a guy that was hard to miss. I mean,
yeah.
He, big, tall guy, super athletic, could do all these cool things. I mean, it's not like he could talk yet or anything, but he didn't talk that much anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Joe, I remember seeing me, Mark Callis, and I was a fan of his at 11 years old. I thought he was cool. I thought he had the heart punch, was a cool finish.
Yep.
He had Paulie as his manager. I mean, how do you miss on a guy like that? I mean, it's ridiculous.
You can add that to the WCW list of incompetence. Like, no, my friends and all liked Mean Mark too. Yeah, the heart punch. He could walk the ropes and dropped an elbow, which was mind blowing for a guy that size. Like, I don't know how he just chalk it up like, well, nothing, this guy is never going to do anything. And then he has a literal quarter century run as a huge star in the competition.
And then people forget that back then, and I think he did a little in WWF, but only at the beginning, his rope walking wasn't just what they call the old school now. And even when he did that, I mean, it was more impressive than it was later. I mean, he would just walk the ropes freehand, not holding onto the ropes, walk like a third of the way down the rope and drop an elbow.
Yeah. He didn't do the whole hit the guy's arm. Yeah, he came off and did an elbow smash.
Although he did both. It was even cooler. I mean, he did both, but yeah.
Yeah, it was even cooler.
I have a question though. When was Suburban Commando shot?
This is around that time period.
Yeah, around here.
Because Hogan
I guess that's how we know that they're scouting. How we know that they're scouting him, right? That must have been where Wade heard it from someone.
Yeah.
Who knew about him being Suburban Commando?
Yeah, but my deal is, Biggs, is, I mean, I guess Ole Anderson must not like the guy, because God forbid that you look at the guys they brought in the rest of the year that were big guys. Let's go over the list. Al Green and Kevin Nash, you know, as what, Maximum Overdrive?
No, they were the Master Blasters. Maximum Overdrive.
That's right, Master Blasters. Then you had Maximum Overdrive. Then you had the Motor City Madman, who sucks.
Curtis Hughes.
Big Cat Curtis Hughes. The Night Stalker. I mean, Jesus Christ. No, wait,
who was the other tag team? Who was the other weird jobber tag team who faced the Steiners on a clash? There was Maximum Overdrive, and there was the other one.
I remember the two mulleted guys, that terrible clash. Oh, that's going to kill me.
Yeah, I'm blanking. I just watched that match recently.
Now, wait, which one was Tim Hunt and
that
Jeff
was Maximum
Warner?
Overdrive.
That was Maximum Overdrive.
So who's the other one?
Oh, Jesus.
It's the three of us. How do none of us remember who this
Magnum
is?
Magnum Force.
Thank you.
Magnum Force.
So who are Magnum Force?
Two other random guys.
These guys, yeah.
Now, I have a question. Have either of you ever seen the title history for Eddie Sharkey's tag titles?
No.
I'm afraid to look at it.
He pretended that the Steiners won the tag titles from Maximum Overdrive, started advertising the Steiners as tag champions, and then stripped them of the titles for not defending them in the PWF.
That's so corny. You gotta love it. That's wrestling right there, folks.
By the way, Magnum Force does not have a Wikipedia entry, so...
That was like a Clint Eastwood film, too, right? So that's probably
true, yeah.
But the main thing, Biggs, is... Ole Anderson, I mean... we know the story behind Kevin Nash was... Joe Hamilton, the assassin, saw Kevin Nash bouncing outside the Cheetah, which is the big strip club in Atlanta.
The one that's not the Gold's Club.
Yeah, the one that's actually reputable and been in business for many, many years. And he was, you know, impressed with this dude's size and said, come on, kid, you know, we'll train you to how to wrestle. And you get the guys like that in there. And Al Green, who's a stiff, who was working in Florida for Steve Kern.
He was teaming with Mark Laurinaitis, right?
Yeah, the Terminator. And you bring these guys in, and you let go of a guy like Mark Callis. It boggles my mind. It's just crazy.
To be fair, there were guys Ole wanted to bring in who they wouldn't let him bring in, or they got upset who he would try to bring in,
Yeah, it's Booker's named Ole, as John McAdam once coined years ago. But anyway, WWF made another move, which what the things they did for so long, but they weren't doing as much in 1990. But it's always funny when they did it, was they changed their house show schedule completely around in the month of October to book the Rosemont Horizon to go head to head against Halloween Havoc on October 27th, 1990, which was in the USC Pavilion. Joe, is that, you know, we're seeing things like that happening today with NXT.
Yeah, exactly.
And ROH. So do you think that like Triple H has gone to the master and studied how to shut out the rival promotions and is trying just to totally reenact this era?
It's just funny because WCW at the time was legitimate competition, and Ring of Honor is like 1,000 light years below the WWF. I mean, it's funny that like, they weren't screwing with pay-per-views anymore, but Vince wasn't below pulling out a stunt like this, which is still pretty funny in hindsight.
Yeah, totally. Now, Vince, go ahead.
Or should I? All right.
Here's what they put up against Halloween Havoc. All right, everybody pretty much, I guess, would know what the Halloween Havoc card was.
Right.
Or if they can't, they can easily look it up. But this is what they put up against it. Ronnie Garvin against the Brooklyn Brawler. Davey Boy Smith against Haku. Tito Santana against an unknown wrestler who's subbing in for the Barbarian, because the Barbarian was subbing for Bobby Heenan against the Big Boss Man. Then Ted DiBiase against Dusty Rhodes. The Hart Foundation against Rhythm and Blues, Honky Tonk Man and Greg Valentine, and Savage Warrior in the main event. And there's no attendance listed. But, I mean, well, if you look at the cards, I mean, Halloween Havoc just blows it away.
Oh, sure.
Right, so what I was going to say, though, was the thing they had – now, I'm trying to remember if they did this after still or which times they did it. There was the thing WWF would also do, which was somehow they would convince the arena that WCW was booking the pay-per-view in to let them have the night before and run late, both to...
They did that in 1989.
Was that only in 89?
Yeah, the Wrestle War show in Nashville.
Now, did they do that any other time?
That's the most famous one.
Okay, because what they would do, they had two goals. They would run these marathon shows. They would run, like, intentionally bad shows with these weird, like, long main events, bad main events, specifically so the fans would be tired out and maybe not want to go the next day if they're buying walk-up tickets. And I guess even if they had already bought tickets, then so they wouldn't be there and the crowd would look less full. And also, so WCW would have less time to set up the arena. Now, like, I know there was all sorts of weird stuff going on with the arena management and WWF and stuff back then, but how do you decide? How are you like, I'm going to have this big event and I'm going to sabotage this event where someone is renting from me? I don't get that.
It's shady business ethics, I guess, but you know, when people are running these buildings, as long as they get paid, I don't think they care. I mean, I don't think they gave a damn who did what, just as long as they got their money. But moving on into a couple of non-wrestling bits. In the August 4th, 1990 issue of The Observer, Dave Meltzer went about at least two pages in depth about the NFL changing up their steroid testing policies and how that could affect wrestling. And there's a lot of interesting stuff in here. Vince, give a quick summation of this article.
Okay, so I'd have to open up to remember some of the specific ones. Well, there's one that sticks out in my mind, well, maybe two. But it was a lot of it was him telling stories that wrestlers had told him. And I think a lot of them were things he had heard over and over from different wrestlers that seemed systematic of problems that steroids had caused for them with their health, with their home life, etc. The ones that stick out for me were, I believe, a wrestler getting into an argument with his wife about fertility and birth, and if not fertility, then birth defects being caused by being on steroids when they conceived or were trying to conceive, and a wrestler, I believe wasn't there also a wrestler who called Dave horrified in tears that he had struck his wife during a roid rage too?
Yes.
Those I recall being the most memorable ones. I mean, am I about right with that?
Yeah, and Dave was pretty in depth about telling like the background of the people he was talking about. And I'm sure if we did enough research, which I didn't do because I really didn't want to, I guess, really try to out people on the air.
Well,
I'm sure we could find out who exactly he was talking about.
I think I know who one of them was, because one of them was a wrestler whose wife got pregnant while he was on steroids and he didn't know it. So, and he said, I would have gotten clean if you were trying to conceive, something like that. Right.
Yeah. And I think that guy is a guy that was, let's just say around this time period, he would have been a full U.S. heavyweight champion.
Oh, that's not who I thought it was. I thought it's the guy been in the news the last week.
Oh, well, it could have been.
Well, hasn't there always been a story about that going around with him?
Yeah, but I heard also about the other guy. But anyway, I mean, the gist of the story, Joe, was that there was fear and for some of the people in the wrestling community that steroids could eventually bring down wrestling, and like fears of them getting canceled off television because of that. I mean, this is 1990, and of course the stuff would happen later on with the trial with Vince and stuff like that, but we're 25 years later and wrestling is still going strong. But of course we've seen all these deaths, you know, over the years due to, you know, complications from years of steroids and other problems, but wrestling still goes on.
Yeah, I mean, they were just about a year away from the whole scandal hitting and then Vince's trial. But yeah, wrestling just for, whatever reason, just under the radar, not something people think about, just keeps on chugging along. And things are better now than they certainly, I imagine, were back then. But like I said, just machine keeps rolling.
Yeah, totally. And believe me, NFL, there are guys using steroids right now. I mean, there's guys get suspended all the time.
Yeah.
It's never changed there. And of course, we had the issues in baseball. So, I mean, it's just one of those things that's going to happen.
But the times that we thought wrestling was going to be brought down entirely did have to do with steroids.
Yes.
On,
it's been a stigma.
I guess at least three different occasions. Sohorian trial, Vince trial, Benoit. Is that what you would say would be the times that we thought wrestling as a whole would be brought down?
But again, it gets stronger and stronger, I guess. It's crazy how it works. But another non-wrestling note, the editor of Matt Watch newsletter, and also at this time was employed by the NWA, working for the WCW or the NWA hotline, Steve Beverly, who was a guy who worked in various television markets in the South, mainly in Georgia. This time was working as the news director at the station in Jackson, Tennessee, suffered a stress attack. And he ended up being fine and never missed the newsletter. But Big Son, he's a guy that had such valuable information that nobody else really did at the time.
Well, so that panic attack or whatever you want to call it, I mean, that ended up being the beginning of the end of Matt Watch, even though it stuck around for another year and a half, because that was why he gave it up. I mean, was that all like weird, like stalking answering machine messages, like general anxiety over wrestling related stuff? And anyway, that's why he gave up Matt Watch in the end. But yeah, I mean, Matt Watch was a fantastic newsletter. I mean, I think people don't realize it these days because it didn't stick around, and I guess people don't really talk about it. I mean, certainly during the early years of the Torch, if you want to say that there was a number two behind the Observer, it was absolutely Matt Watch. In some respects, Matt Watch was better, even better than the Observer at that point. I mean, Matt Watch, it was not quite as well laid out as the Torch would become, but it was certainly better laid out than the Observer. I mean, but he had information the Observer didn't have, that it was focused on the TV side meant he would report stuff that maybe Dave didn't report, either with indies or other stuff about different promotions were doing on TV. He would get a tape of every single indie promotion, and he would review the TV. I mean, but really what he would do was that he'd have the lineup of each show, would give like a rating to each match and a rating to each show. But still, I mean, you can get a picture of each week's TV that, from Matt Watch, which you can't really do with the other newsletters, and but like everything, like all of the indie shows, all the WWF and WCW shows, etc. And
it was a perfect companion to the Observer and Torch.
Yes. What would I say? Like, he had different things too. Like, I guess he had lines of the week from the announcers, which Torch eventually, I guess when Matt Watch went out of business, Torch picked it up with their quote book.
Yes.
But lines of the week was a big deal. Like, you'll see on old Global shows, Scott Hudson and Craig Johnson will talk about blah blah blah. No, that's a line of the week because they were trying to get into Matt Watch, which eventually they realized was kind of dumb on that part, and they probably shouldn't have done announcing solely to do jokes to get into Matt Watch. But it's I can't say enough good about Matt Watch. Really, I mean, like, this was the first time you had read it in a while, right?
Yeah, it's been since that time period. And,
I mean,
and
it's
awesome.
It's an incredible wealth of information, and we are trying to, at least for ourselves, put together a complete collection, and we hope to do so soon. But if you want to see what's floating around, Jason Campbell's archive, which we've talked about last week and we'll talk about a lot, his Google Drive folders that he has on linked off ProWrestlingHistory.com, in his, I believe it's his other, one of his other collections, he has, I believe, the first three Matt Watch annuals, 88, 88, 88, 88. And the giant thing really good. So check, if you want to read any Matt Watch, check those out.
Now, Joe, he went from being, having this newsletter and stuff like that to becoming like the preeminent game show historian, which is one of my favorite like career shifts. there's not a whole lot of difference between wrestling on television and game shows on television, is there?
Not to my knowledge. No. I just want to say, like, you guys have been immersed in this. I know you did a show on these. Looking over like some like Matt Watch I'd never really seen before. Like, I would have killed to have stuff like this back then. This stuff is fascinating and kind of the kind of, you know, underground do it yourself, you know, almost like a punk rock, you know, newsletter you would put together here that just seems really invaluable at the time. Like, I never would have seen anything like it at the
he had one of the big satellite dishes, so he was able to watch so much stuff that people that had just regular antenna or just regular cable were never able to watch. In 1990, and my oldest brother had a satellite dish, so I would go to his house and watch stuff that, you know, from all over the place too. But it was just like it was a big deal because those things were huge and cost a lot of money. And it isn't like now where you got your DirecTV and your Dish Network and stuff like that. I mean, that was, like I said, a big deal for you to have a satellite dish. And like I said, he was able to watch all this different stuff. So, and like I said, he never missed one of the newsletters. He came back, he wrote about his problem, and kept on going for the next year or so.
You know, and let's just, before we move on, let's just count all of the shows in that week's TV tempo, just to give an idea of everything that he was watching and pulling down on satellite, okay? So we've got... So we've got the WWF syndicated shows. So Challenge and Superstars. Pro Wrestling 90, which was... So was that technically Pro Wrestling this week's follow-up, or was it North Georgia? What was it?
It was a combination. It was more North Georgia, or Georgia All-Star Wrestling, which was Joe Pennison's promotion, and a mixture of some other stuff.
Right, and they'd also, right, like, because I'm looking at this one, there's Puerto Rico, there's Calgary, outdated Calgary, there's Portland.
It's mainly international stuff.
Yeah, but was it only on in Atlanta?
Yes.
Okay. Wasn't there also a Pro Wrestling 90 on TSN, though?
Yeah, but that wasn't that.
But was that Pro Wrestling Plus, or was it something else?
Pro Wrestling Plus.
And so it was Pro Wrestling, so it was similar, but I think Pro Wrestling 90 only aired... would like air a couple of years old Crockett stuff?
I think Pro Wrestling 90... That was the Joe Pedicino stuff. I think it did get like some syndication in this area, like in Chattanooga or stuff like that.
Right. Okay. So anyway, so the two WCW syndicated shows, Worldwide and Pro, USWA syndicated show, which was Wrestling Challenge, and also, wait, what's USWA Best of Championship Wrestling here? I don't even know what that would be that he's
reviewing. That would probably be the Jackson, Tennessee show.
But that stopped airing. That stopped airing in '88.
No, it was airing, but not airing house shows.
Oh, okay. I thought it stopped airing in '88.
No, they just didn't air house shows no more.
It was just replay of stuff.
Replay television.
Okay, so LPWA in syndication, Ladies Pro Wrestling Association, which was, I think they were also on Sports Channel America too. Yeah. I guess he was getting TSN on his satellite because we got a CNWA review, which was the promotion that replaced Stampede. Svaldi's ICW, Windy City Wrestling, which aired on whatever the equivalent of Sports Channel Chicago was. Primetime Wrestling. IWA, Rob Rawson's promotion that DDP was doing announcing for.
Which we'll talk about later on.
Yes. Southeastern, which I don't... this isn't Southeastern. This is... Or is this? Oh no, it is. It is called maybe something called Southeastern.
It was a short-lived indie that they did like a couple of TV episodes and just replayed those episodes for like 2 months.
Because I'm trying to see who these names are. I see Jim Boss from UWFI, and that's the only name I recognize.
Yeah, different guys.
And he has All Japan. Okay, so All Japan and New Japan, which obviously he's getting tapes of, and he notes that they're older. They're not from the same week. USWA on WMC, which he was getting the same week, but I'm guessing, I don't know if that would be on a dish. WCW on TBS. And, World Championship Wrestling, WCW Main Event. Portland, Saturday Night's Main Event. That's it.
So, I mean, that was all the stuff he was watching. In 1 week. It's like Joe in written podcast. You know? he was doing a TV mass thread on the Matt Watch newsletter. Just a guy that was just a totally invaluable resource. And, it's a shame that he didn't stay in it longer. But, hey, whatever you got to do for your health, man, I'm into it. Mm. But on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to go across the seas and head to Japan, where we have some pretty big dealings going on with Terry Bam Bam Gordy. We'll be right back after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation, placetobenation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to The Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on The Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
Do you watch pro wrestling? Do you love pro wrestling? We do too. And there's only one podcast feed that you can't miss.
PWO PTBN Podcast Network. That's the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation Podcast Network.
We have a host of brilliant shows dedicated to wrestling past and present.
Whether it's the territories, Japan, Lucha, old school or new school, we've got something for you.
Get a dose of history on Exile on Bad Street with Chris Zellner.
Listen to reviews of current pay-per-views on the PTBN reaction shows. Not just WWE, but New Japan, Ring of Honor, and NXT. And get your weekly update on everything else that's going on in the indies, Lucha, and beyond on This Week in Wrestling.
Relive WCW Supercards on Where the Big Boys Play with Parv and Chad.
Join Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave on one of the very best shows for super hardcore nerds, Wrestling Culture.
Go deep into WWF history and discover the Bob Backlund and Bruno Sammartino eras on Titans of Wrestling.
Don't miss the Pro Wrestling Super Show with Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston.
You can get the full archive of Goodwill Wrestling with Good Ol' Will from Texas.
There's tag teams back again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze.
Then there's the only pro wrestling game show, Brainbuster, with me, Johnny Sorrow, and a panel of great guests every time.
Get them all on one feed.
PWO-PTBN Podcast Network.
You know you want to hear it.
All right, hello everyone, and we're back. And please listen to all those great shows that you just heard advertised on the Place to Be Nation Network. I approve of all of them, especially that Exile on Bad Street show hosted by some guy. So yeah, go listen to all those shows. But anyway, we're back on this show, Between the Sheets, Episode 2, with David Bixaspan and Joe Gagne. And we're talking about the week of wrestling, July 27th through August 3rd, 1990. And now we are in the land of the rising sun in Japan, and we're talking about All Japan, which was going through quite an interesting shift in talent and booking and a lot of stuff going on this time period. And the big story of quite a few big stories this week is their Triple Crown champion, Terry Gordy, collapsing from dehydration after a match with Dr. Dusty Williams against Stan Hansen and Terry Taylor in Isasaki on July 26th. Now, the reason why it fits in this timeline is at 3 a.m. on July 27th, Gordy was playing foosball with Dr. Death in a bar and collapsed in the middle of the game. It was found out that he had taken a large dose of Percodan earlier and chased it with beer and whiskey, which he had the whiskey in the bar after the show, on an empty stomach. He had done all this stuff, worked the show, no food, and he just collapsed. He was having serious breathing issues and was put on a respirator, but he regained consciousness soon thereafter and was released from the hospital on July 29th, which the tour ended on the 27th, and he flew back home to the United States. Originally, he was listed in critical condition after in the hospital, and there was a small prayer vigil held by Giant Baba, Dr. Death, and some of the other office employees because they were scared they had another David Von Erich on their hands, the David Von Erich tragedy. This is the first of Terry Gordy's major health issues. And before he had these issues, he was just a machine in the ring, a guy like, you know, we had very rarely seen of his size and, you know, ability. Talk about how Terry Gordy became like a different man after his health problems.
Yeah, it just wasn't the same as they progressed. He just was really a shell of his former self, which was too bad. I mean, he was just so naturally talented and just so good, really, everywhere he went. And I just kind of wonder, like, gosh, what if it was like another David Von Erich situation, what that would have done to All Japan?
Oh, man, because at this time, like I said, they were having so many issues that this could have really, like, crippled the company.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And like I said, he was the Triple Crown champion, and he was supposed to defend that night against Misawa and Matsuda. And what they did was they decided just to have a decision match for the title between Misawa and Stan Hansen. And you would think maybe Misawa would, you know, win that match, but no, they held strong to their booking because of what they had down the road. And Hansen beat Misawa clean with a lariat in 1606. Now, Bix, do you think that they should have stayed the course with that move, or should they have hot shot the belt on Misawa then, or what do you think they should have done?
Now, when did Misawa actually end up winning the Triple Crown for the first time?
92, I want to say.
Somewhere, let me check real quick. Oh, go ahead.
If they had done it, I don't see any reason why it wouldn't have done well, given the climate with Misawa at the time, unless that was more of a Tokyo thing. But
August 22nd, 1992, from Stan Hansen.
Yeah, I mean, unless his early popularity was more Tokyo-centric than we think of it as, I don't see why they couldn't have done it. Because, I mean, when you think about just how hot he was at this point, I mean, because less than 2 months removed from the win over Jumbo. So, I mean, it would not have been ridiculous at all to put the title on Misawa, but it also, I mean, it's Hansen. So losing to Hansen doesn't damage him.
Yeah, and Hansen and Jumbo would trade the title back and forth until that when Misawa won the title. But you look at what's going on in the time, you know, Tenryu has then left, and they're in a situation where they're going through a complete change in philosophy. Right. And like I said, maybe going to Misawa would have been the right move to further, you know, show that shift.
Now, we should be clear, by the way, this was not the incident that permanently caused the brain damage for Gordy. Was that 92 or 93?
That was 92.
Yeah.
But this is like the first deal.
This was a big deal at the time. I mean, this was, yeah. I mean,
who knows how long Gordy would have been champion? Because, I mean, he had just won the Triple Crown title, you know, in June. So.
He'd had a previous run that was only like 3 days, I guess, to transition to Hansen. So, but you're right, it's hard to say. But as for Misawa, given what, you know, the business they did, I don't really think you can say they made a wrong move here.
It's
one they could have done that maybe would have been as good or a little better.
So. Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, it wasn't like they, you know, crippled themselves, like I said, business wise. But it's just interesting. And a day later, you know, you had the Great Kabuki, who is one half of the World Tag Team Champions, which they had just. He had just won the belts with Jumbo Shiruda on July 19th from Gordy and Williams, which was their first loss as a tag team. And he had announced via telegram to Giant Baba that he is quitting All Japan and joining the new upstart SWS. and he was vacating his titles.
Dear Mr. Baba, stop. Yeah. In spite of our nation's tradition of loyalty to your employer, I am leaving for all of the money that the eyeglass company is offering me. Stop.
And here's the deal. He followed Yoshiaki Yatsu, who left the week before to go to SWS.
Thank you for making me a main eventer when I didn't really deserve it. Stop.
Yeah, and so Baba had offered Kabuki a $35,000 signing bonus and paid for his children to come from the United States to watch him wrestle, which they had rarely done over the years. So, I mean, Baba was trying to go all out to save this guy. And his last match, he teamed with Jumbo, and they beat this young upstart team of Kenta Kobashi and Akira Taue. And so Baba's all pissed off, and he said he's going to sue everybody that's left to go to SWS. But before that, though, he decides as a token of goodwill, he's going to take the entire roster on a week-long vacation of Hawaii. And then he had already started the process signing all of his guys to 5-year contracts to keep them from jumping. Now,
By the way,
go ahead.
Keep in mind that Baba owned a lot of property in Hawaii. So when you consider that Japan to Hawaii is not a ridiculous flight, it's possible this only cost him the airfare.
Yeah. Now, Joe, Giant Baba was scared. I mean, this is a guy that's really scared of what's happening to a promotion. I mean, look, he's doing stuff that you never hear wrestling promoters do.
No. Yeah, I think it's it's awesome to take the roster on a vacation to Hawaii. I try to get away from my coworkers on vacation, so I don't know how relaxing that would have been. But it's funny to hear these stories when you know about the decade All Japan would have. And how many mass exoduses have there been from All Japan? I could think of three. There was this one, the one in 2000, and then the one a couple of years ago when Muda left for WrestleMania. Hysterical how this always keeps happening to them.
But you look at the first two times it happened, they ended up being stronger just about in the aftermath because they turned Tenryu in 87 and put him with Hara, the former Revolution, which was a big deal. And then after this happened, you get the next generation of Misawa, Kawada, Kobashi, Kikuchi, Taue, all those guys, you know, becoming big stars.
And in 2000, 2001, I mean, the first few months were hard.
They made the deal with
New Japan, and then Hase brokered the deal for Muto, Kojima, and Kashin to come over.
Yeah, 2001, 2002.
And Muta to get his backers to buy it, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, and yeah, so really three times they came back stronger than what they were.
Well, the 2000 one was not stronger than they were, but stronger than anyone could have expected.
Yeah, but 2000 All Japan, though, was not 1995 All Japan.
You know, 2000, they were relying on a pad hand, but they still did good Budokan numbers for a few years, didn't they?
Yeah, but they were in a situation where they were starting to – you were seeing the same guys.
No, I'm talking about after.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was not better than before, but it was about as good as you could have expected.
Yeah.
Considering we thought the company would die, I would say much better than...
Yeah, I mean, because
the only guy they had under contract was Fuchi. And then Fuchi and Kawada. They were the only two guys.
The only natives.
Yeah, and then they just started bringing in some of the most randomest people and... You know, New Japan.
Those early post-split shows are so weird. So, I mean, you've got the first two big shows. You've got the Fuji Kawada match, which was like almost – they're trying to establish a new style kind of to be built around Kawada. Like instead of – they're not going to do the head drops or anything anymore. It's going to be very stiff. So it was that – you've got that famous photo of Fuji's chest all red from the chops. And then there was the surprise return to Tenryu, and they did Tenryu and Kawada against Hansen in Taiokea, which was Hansen's last great match, and it was obviously a big deal to see Tenryu and Kawada back together. But then you had all these weird, indie guys on the undercard. I want to say you had guys from, why am I forgetting the name of the promotion all of a sudden?
Well, they worked with Michinoku Pro.
Kageki, I think.
Kageki. Yeah. They worked with everybody. They worked with Toriumon. They worked with everybody.
They brought in guys from Mexico.
In Mexico.
They brought in Mexico's Most Wanted, right?
Yeah. I mean, they brought in all kinds of people. But, it's just one of the many issues of drama in All Japan. And New Japan had it too. And in fact, moving on to New Japan, they're not in tour right now. So the big story that's going on there is involving Koji Kitao, who Koji Kitao was a huge star in Japan as far as crossover, because he was a big time sumo guy.
He was sumo and got kicked out of sumo for punching, what was it, a promoter, a sponsor?
Yeah.
And he did a giant TV rating for New Japan for his debut against Bigelow earlier that year.
Yeah, and it was a deal where Riki Choshu was the booker. And Riki Choshu was wanting to, humble him. And he was wanting him the job to the Japanese guys, which Kitao had done jobs for the foreign guys, no problem, because they were perceived as, big stars. Well, Kitao got tired of all this and said, I'm not jobbing to any more natives. And Choshu said, well, you're going to job or you're gone. And basically Kitao walked out. Well, Antonio Inoki is now getting back in the power from, we talked about the last show where he was elected to the House of Representatives. Well, now he's starting to get back in power. And he was a fan of Kitao, and he wanted, them to work out a deal. Well, Choshu said, well, if Kitao comes back, he's jobbing to me directly in a singles match. But
it gets worse.
The big issue, though, is right before this, Kitao gave this interview to all the major newspapers in Tokyo, like Daily Sport, Nikkan, Yomiuri, all these different newspapers, saying that called Choshu a stupid Korean. Now, it's the first time that Choshu's ancestry, his heritage, was revealed to the general public. I mean, it was one of those things where you knew it, probably, but it wasn't talked about. And the reason why that is the Japanese really hate the Koreans. I mean, it is a long-standing deal. I guess it's kind of like how Mexicans and Puerto Ricans have issues in a way. But, this is pretty bad stuff. Who do you sympathize in this whole story? You sympathize with the promotion, Choshu, or Kitao?
Well, given Kitao's antics in sumo and in this here, I would side with the company and Choshu in particular. And Kitao ended up getting fired over this, right? And he went to SWS.
Then he went to SWS.
Yep.
He went to World War Tenro. And Bis Kitao is a guy who was never a great worker. And folks remember, he did work WrestleMania, the WrestleMania 7 with his partner. And and the fact that Kitao was just, I guess we could probably maybe compare him to like Tadao Yasuda in a way, but Yasuda was a better wrestler and had way more time in it.
Maybe like Wajima, but with less time, at least at the peak of his stardom.
Yeah, he liked Wajima, but not as nearly as professional.
And a bigger star at the time. The thing is, like, I don't remember. I don't think I could really. I don't know if I felt this way whenever I saw this match. I don't remember when I last saw it. But the Bigelow match, though, at the time, even though he wasn't considered great work, like, there were people who saw that match and thought that he was amazing for his first match.
Yeah, well, Bigelow was at that time was still pretty damn good.
Well, if anyone can carry Bigelow was really good at making other guys look good.
And All Japan at that time had some. I mean, All Japan, New Japan at that time had some really tough. Because Dr. Death was still around. They were doing the talent trading with All Japan, but Dr. Death was still technically a New Japan guy.
Right.
So yeah, Dr. Death was there. Bigelow was there. Trying to think of, I mean, you had, as far as natives, you had Choshu and Saito, I mean, Hashimoto. You had some really tough dudes there. So it wasn't like Kitao was jobbing.
Were any of the Russians still there?
The Russians at that time had kind of faded away.
Well, Hashimikov might have still been there, right?
I think the Russians were pretty much done after 89.
Didn't WCW push the Russians through New Japan, book the Russians through New Japan, though?
In Starcade, they worked Starcade, but they may have worked 1990. I can't really remember off the top of my head. They weren't anything big. It wasn't like 1989, though.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it was like Katawa was jobbing to Jushin Thunder Liger or anything.
Yeah. This reminds me of my favorite story of Katao being an asshole, but it's kind of it's one where you kind of side with him. I think Chris has heard this one. I don't know if Joe has. So I forget why, but he was working an indie show in Pittsburgh. Chris, do you know where I'm going with this?
Vaguely.
And I don't remember why. And this is like, what, mid-90s, something like that? So he's wrestling Preston Steel. So if anyone remembers the name Preston Steel, again, you probably remember him from Rob Russin's IWA, which we'll talk about again later, where he was the IWA Intercontinental Champion. And he somehow was hooked against Koji Katao in the main event of this show. So Preston Steel goes up to him before the match, and he's like, "Hello. In America, we work light," and then like touches him very lightly, "not stiff," and pantomimes hitting him hard. And he's like, "Okay." And then Katao nods. He turns to our old friend, Surly Doe, Sam Panico, and I'm not speaking out of turn because I know he's told the story publicly. And he says, "Doesn't this motherfucker know I speak English?" So then the match happens. I want to say it's like the first move or something. He gives him a chokeslam or an uraganagi and separates his shoulder. And there's a great picture of that. That was in one of the Japanese magazines.
So, Koji Katao is a great human being. and there's all kinds of different stories that's went around over the years about him. And his career didn't last very long either. So, yeah, it's just one of those big deals. I mean, think of like Naoya Ogawa, but I mean, Ogawa, you know, ended up being more professional and adapting later on.
Well, and when Ogawa was unprofessional too, it was not entirely his fault.
No, it wasn't.
He was told to put a hit on people by his bosses, and who knows culturally what the deal would be with that. And and also Katao, of course, got into the weird shoot incidents with John Tenta in SWS.
Yes, yeah, which is, you know, another story.
And Takada knocked him out with a shoot kick to the head.
Yeah. Now, Hiroshi Hase at this time has become the assistant booker under Choshu, basically booking the junior heavyweights and stuff like that.
Well, so it was Liger not Booker yet at this point then?
Oh, no.
When did he become Booker? 93, 94?
Yeah, later on. Yeah. Basically when Hase pretty much was...
They're going to politics.
Doing his political stuff. Well, Hase wanted to bring in Brian Pillman. And he wanted him to be a regular. And Pillman's contract in WCW was coming to an end, I think at the end of the year or going early in 91. He wanted him to be like Owen Hart and Chris Benoit was at this time, who those are two of Brian's best friends. Brian Pillman at this time was starting to get phased out. Ole did not like Brian Pillman. I don't know exactly what the deal was there, but he didn't like him, and he was phasing him down the car. Pillman's a guy, Joe, that he would get these on and off pushes in WCW like crazy. I mean, and you look at imagine him going to New Japan and working in that division in that era against guys like Liger, which he did eventually. But, you know, Liger, Dave Finley, Negro Casas, guys like that. I mean, wow. I mean, those could be some all-time classic matches.
Was Pillman and Hase in Stampede at the same time?
Yes. Viet Cong Express. That's okay. Right.
So I thought that was interesting. He was interested in Pillman the year before he worked with Liger. But, yeah, that probably would have been the best thing for Pillman because his size would not have been the detriment it was in WCW. And, yeah, I mean, they would – you know, Pillman would have spurts here and just do nothing for a long time at the yellow dog angle. So kind of a shame it never materialized. It probably would have been the best thing for him, certainly from an in-ring standpoint, probably from a career one as well.
Yeah, because you look at Pillman, I mean, he had that great early run where he was feuding with Luger, and he had that great match with Flair on television and all that stuff. And they put him with Zinc.
And they had U.S. tag titles,
They were U.S. tag champions and pretty good in that role. But then he just, like, he faded into the mid-card and low mid-card off and on. I mean, of course, he had the War Games match, you know, in 91 at WrestleMore and all that stuff with the Horsemen then. And then, of course, eventually leading to the you know, the feud with Wyndham and Yellow Dog. And then, you know, the Dangerous Alliance era, basically he was a guy that worked against Dangerous Alliance, but he was mainly just a light heavyweight guy working against Johnny B. Badd, Liger, Richard Morton. And then eventually he turned in 92, and that's when, you know, they started the Hollywood Brawn run after that. But Pillman,
And then when that's done, start and stop for another two and a half years.
Yeah, exactly. Was Bix just one of the most underutilized guys of the era?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if some of it has to do with being seen as like favorites of guy of like a favorite of Flair and Jim Ross, and I guess to an extent, Jim Barnett too.
My boy.
But I'm trying to remember.
Was my boy, I love you in those Bengal collars.
It should be white, though.
Yes, I prefer the white ties. But
that's actually, by the way, that's actually a real thing. That is not a Jim Barnett gay joke. He really liked putting baby faces into white ties. Well, because one of his things, which I think was in, the obituary Dave Meltzer did for him, was that as a gay man who understood pro wrestling, he felt like he understood the appeal that the wrestlers would have to women and gay men.
Yeah.
So it's not like it was just him being this leering old queen, so to speak. I hope people understand I'm using that as a pejorative for people looking at him that way and not the... I'm not calling him that. I mean, when he's saying that, that's not just him wanting to see Brian Pillman or Tom Zank in small white trunks. That's him thinking that they'd get over more in small white trunks.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I'm off base in saying that, right?
I think there's definitely...
And it's people, and it's also just people, we love to do the voice.
Yeah, anytime Jim Barnett's mentioned, somebody has to do the voice. I mean...
Even just to say my boy.
My boy. But, yeah, totally. Pillman's a guy who, you know, if he went to New Japan, that could have changed his career, but...
Now, you know what, though? Honestly, I never thought he looked small in WCW.
He didn't. He really did. I mean, yeah, he wasn't as big as body wise, but height wise, he was okay.
He was not that short. He was not that, you know, small like physique. I mean, I always thought it was weird that he was pegged as that much of a small guy. Like he looked credible against Luger. He looked credible against Flair. I mean, he even looked credible against Wyndham, who's the tallest of those guys. So
yeah,
I don't get it. It's so weird, though, that such a guy who's... And he was such a complete performer, too, so quickly. Like, he had gotten... He was by far the best promo guy in Stampede, especially the baby faces. More of the baby faces, because I guess...
Yeah, we talked about this on the last show when we were talking about the Bash. About, I mean, he was a natural type of guy in the ring. You know, he had it early. And, yeah, I mean, just... who knows what can happen. It's a loss deal. But, you know, talking about Ric Flair, let's move on to SWS. And Tenryu is, you know, trying to start up, you know, this promotion. And their first show is going to be in October. And he desperately wants to work against Ric Flair.
Boy, those guys really wanted to work with each other for a long time, didn't they?
Yeah. You know, we talked about that in the death of Crockett in 1988, that Flair wanted, Tenryu to come in.
For Starrcade, right?
For Starrcade, you know, to work against, because he wanted to change the style of wrestling in the promotion. And he thought Tenryu would be a great guy to establish that style against. But Flair, of course, had lost the NWA title at this time. And it kind of had lessened the oomph behind that type of match. So Tenryu is now trying to talk to Terry Funk and Ricky Steamboat about coming in. Which, of course, neither of them did. And I can't remember. Who did Tenryu work on the first match? The first NWA show?
Let's see.
Well, I can't remember, but anyway, the hierarchy of SWS at this time was Tenryu and K.Y. Wakamatsu, who was the heel manager in New Japan in the late 80s. He managed the Machines, Andre, all those guys. They were the co-general managers. The booker was Kazuo Sakurada, of course, Kendo Nagasaki, Dragon Master. And Mr. Hito, the... famed Japanese wrestler that based out of Calgary was the assistant booker. So there's your hierarchy of SWS. So basically, you know, you see what style they were going with. They're going with that old style, all Japan, you know, classic deal. And
So the first show, because SWS Straight and Strong was the first show, right?
Yeah.
October 18th?
Yes.
Okay. So they had a tag team tournament.
Yeah.
And the finals, which I guess are sort of the main event, were Tenryu and Kabuki against the Takanos. And then the second show, the next night, had Tenryu versus George, I think. Yeah, Tenryu versus George.
So, yeah, totally, totally different than having a Flair, Funk, or Steamboat there on that show.
Yeah, and then
but,
I love some of the other matches on this that you've got. Look at, like, Naoki Sano versus Jeff Jarrett.
Yeah, going on Naoki Sano. Naoki Sano, of course, had left New Japan, and it was
right, we were just going to talk about this.
Yeah, there's a legal issue there where he can't wrestle for SWS until that got cleared up. So he,
not that there was an SWS to wrestle for yet.
No, but yeah, he couldn't legally work for him. So he had to go to the United States. And at this time period, it's a totally different system than what it used to be. So he's bouncing around working for Killer Brooks in Texas for Lone Star. Then he goes to work in UWA Mexico, which he teamed up with a young kid named Yoshinori Asai there, who of course would become Ultimo Dragon. He went to work in Calgary a little bit for CNWA. But the deal here, though, is just funny because you mentioned Jeff Jarrett. He originally went to Jerry Jarrett, you know, to try to get work.
But, which makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, because Jerry Jarrett used many Japanese guys over the years, young guys. But Jerry declined the offer. And the talk was that it was mainly New Japan was, like, I guess maybe putting the screws to Sano. But eventually, you know, they worked the deal out where Jeff Jarrett went in. So,
and Sano was on the first two shows.
Yeah.
Right, so like Sano, I just said, yeah, it was Sano and Jarrett, so.
Yeah, so they worked together.
And also, wasn't, I guess, since it was technically a Jerry Jarrett show, wasn't Sano on the, even if it wasn't a televised match, wasn't he at or even on the global pilot taping at the Sportatorium at the end of the year?
Yes.
I don't remember if he had a match on TV, but I think he was there.
Yeah. So, because Dragon Master was also, Sakurada was working those areas.
Yeah, he was a regular in Dallas. He was mostly working for Gary Hart, right?
Yeah. Now this is my favorite SWS story. this is great stuff. SWS opens up a gym, you know, which, you know, wrestling promotions in Japan, you have to have the dojo, and they open up in Yokohama, and some of their high paid talent, such as Samson Fuyuki, of course, with Riki Fuyuki, Koto Fuyuki, Shinichi Nakano and Shunji Takano weren't coming in. They just were just sitting at home. And the talk was that the wrestlers were, these guys got paid this big bonus money for leaving All Japan and decided just to sit at home, get fat and lazy. Now, Joe, we've seen this in real sports where guys would, you know, when they signed that big contract, they would show up to camp out of shape, or they were never the same other than after they had that contract year where they went and earned their money. So, I mean, this is just a tradition in sports.
I guess so. It's nothing that usually comes up in wrestling because you have to usually work on the earn your money based on what you draw, which wasn't the case. Yeah, you get your fat bonuses. Hey, why not? So that's finally, yeah, that was interesting too, that Tenryu was mad at these men for getting fat and lazy.
Go ahead.
And let's be honest with these three. All right, Nakano was mainly a junior type guy.
And a tag team wrestler, yeah.
And Fuyuki and Takano were guys who were already pudgy as they were.
And Fuyuki had started to gain a lot of weight before he left All Japan.
Yeah. Which is funny because he had the Samson gimmick at this time. So,
more of the hair.
Yeah, it's about the hair, but still, Samson, though, is known for his physique. Which, yeah. But SWS, I mean, this is a promotion that had potential, had a lot of money into it, but man, did it fall on its face.
When they got TV, what network did they have the TV on?
I think they were TV Tokyo.
Okay.
I think. I don't quote me on that, but I think they were. It had been either them or Fuji.
Yeah.
So because that, I mean, New Japan was on Asai and All Japan was on NTV, so.
I've never actually watched much of it. I've only seen a little. I know it's supposed to be better than it got credit for.
Yeah, but
no one really talks about, like, no one has fond memories like old Michinoku Pro. And
it wasn't, you know, war.
That. Yeah,
war,
it, yeah,
totally overshadows SWS in a lot of ways. You know, it's just, I guess maybe it's because of the talent that worked with war, because they had, you know, they worked with New Japan and all that stuff. And SWS, though, I mean, they were the first to regularly bring in the WWF guys since New Japan, because of the working relationship with WWF. Mm. So you would have, you know, those guys coming in. But,
and that's really, I would think, because Mogame Super had the money that WWF would want to be like, hey, sure, we'll send guys over.
Yeah. So yeah, that was the deal there. So SWS, a footnote in Japanese wrestling history. But moving on, we're going to go to Canada now and very quickly talk about CNWA, which was Canadian National Wrestling Association, which took the place of Stampede, which pretty much died early in 1990. And they held a tournament to determine their first champion. And two longtime Stampede guys, Jerry Morrow and Biff Wellington, a.k.a. Beef Wellington, you know, was the match, and Jerry Morrow won. Now, Biggs, Beef Wellington's a guy who, I mean, he worked the NWA World Tag Titles Tournament in 1992. On TBS, but a guy that was, you know, never gets talked about, was a pretty damn good worker.
Yeah, after 1990, I don't remember, and other than that tournament, I don't remember him showing up anywhere either, too, because I think he was still in New Japan a little at this point, wasn't he?
Yes.
He was still working like a bottom of the card, like junior heavyweight foreigner, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was a really good worker. I mean, he wasn't as good as, he wasn't necessarily as good as Benoit or Pillman, but he was very, very good. And he might have even been better than Pillman while they were in Calgary, at least, because Pillman improved a lot, too. I mean, not that he was bad, but he improved a lot once he was in WCW. But he took big bumps, just had that similar kind of Dynamite Kid-inspired style that all those other guys who came through Calgary did. And not as good of a look as some of the other guys, just in terms of, like, he had the same, you know, the type of physique that the other guys did, but what's the best way to say it? Because I'm not calling him ugly, but he looked. Do you know what I mean? Just like the hair, the way he had the hair and the mustache and stuff, just did was not.
He looked like a small Hercules Hernandez.
Kind of, yeah. He doesn't really get talked about much because, you know, he didn't, other than people watching the NWA tournament wondering who this guy is. Unless people are really, you know, more familiar with Calgary, they don't really talk about him. And the CNWA, for those who don't know, I mean, the way it replaced Stampede, besides just being a place for local wrestlers to work, was that it was, I forget the, it was, it's Fred May or Fred Mayford?
Fred May.
And it was Mayford Productions, right?
Yeah.
That did, he was behind the Stampede show, like he produced it, but he was also the guy with the casino, right?
And they brought in Ed Whalen as announcer.
Right, so he had this casino with what was it, the Silver Dollar Action Center?
Yeah.
And that's where they taped the TV, and they brought in Ed Whalen as the announcer, and they did it as casino, and it lasted into, what, 91?
Yeah.
And
then went away.
And didn't TSN also pick up Tony Candela's shows for a little while after CNWA went away?
Yeah. But moving on to Puerto Rico, where we had more legal issues. Hector Cruz
in Puerto
Ayala,
Rico?
Yeah, Hector Cruz Ayala, a.k.a. Hercules Ayala, was given a 5-year suspended sentence after pleading guilty to 2 charges of narcotics possession. Ayala was accused of selling cocaine to some undercover cops on 2 separate occasions in 1989. Ayala could not leave his house after 6 p.m. and must stay in drug treatment, as well as staying away from anyone using or selling drugs. He also can't return to wrestling.
So if I was going to think of a – yes. If I was going to name a WWC star during that period who looked like a cocaine dealer, it would probably be Hercules Ayala. What? We just learned that he actually was a cocaine dealer. Did Chris just disappear?
Yes, you're right there. I don't know. Is Chris still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I had to.
Okay.
I had to step away for just a second. Yeah, Ayala's a guy who, he was not a great worker. I mean, but he was effective in that role of being, you know, this bigger guy who was getting these wild brawls with Cologne. But yeah, he had the look of a guy who definitely would do some shady ass shit. I mean, he had the black hair, but he had like a silver part of it, where I mean, he he had this distinct look about him, and he could have been some type of hitman for some local cartel or something like that.
I don't even want to know why he was in Calgary in the first place when he was there. Maybe it wasn't for wrestling first.
Well, they send all those guys there.
I know, but maybe
Chicky Star.
Maybe he had other business.
He was young back then, so I doubt that.
He wasn't young. He was in Calgary like 5 years before, 5 or 6 years before.
But he was in Calgary before that.
Okay, that's true. Oh, that's true. Yeah, probably with Colon as Carlos Belafonte.
So yeah, he was around a lot and stuff. But Joe, I mean, cocaine, wrestling, I mean, hand in hand, right?
Wait a second. I hate to interrupt. What did Vladimir Petrov deal? Was it cocaine?
No, he was into other stuff.
Was it just steroids?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But Joe, cocaine wrestling.
I don't believe it. I like how it says he can't return to wrestling, and then of course he just returned to wrestling in a few years. So I guess they just figured it was okay.
And even during the house arrest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's Puerto Rico. I mean, you know, the invader was wrestling during all that flirty stuff. So, I mean, it is what it is. But moving to the States and talk about the AWA, who at this time period was on death's door. And they were on their television, which was showing all kinds of random stuff.
Now, when was the last taping?
The August 11th.
Okay, but we're not quite there yet.
Which had been delayed from July 30th. But they were showing older matches with new commentary. But on the program, and they were pimping up this cruise they were going to go on, where you could sail the seas with Vern and Greg Gagne. Joe, could think of like a Love Boat here, where Vern is Captain Steubing, and Greg is playing Gopher, okay, Fred Grandy. Can you hear me? But the thing is, who would be the Isaac? Vern didn't put black guys.
They can't get over in this territory.
Yeah, they can't get over there.
Oh, I guess they would just have to skip that part. Eric Bischoff could fill in with some other duties.
Oh, yeah, Eric Bischoff.
He could be the gopher.
Eric Bischoff
was the gopher, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, yeah, literally. I mean, he could definitely could have been. That's right.
Yeah.
No, Greg could have been Doc. He could have been Bernie Capel's character, maybe. Now,
did this ever happen, or
is I don't think it ever happened. I think they were just listening to money.
Or it's entirely possible that Vern and Greg were just going on a cruise, and they were getting a commission for anyone they could get to go on that cruise with them.
I think they're just trying to get a free cruise. They're trying to get the fans to pay for them to be on. That's what I think. But, we talk about cocaine and wrestling. Ponzi schemes and wrestling go together very well, too. I mean, God knows we've seen it over the years. But, I mean, it's just – I mean, that could be that could have been a comedy show. They could have televised that, the Vern and Greg on a cruise, and did a show based around that.
You know, they end up in Hawaii where they run into the All Japan roster on vacation.
Yeah. They did the Teen Challenge series in Hawaii.
Oh, God.
And knowing Vern, it'd be like Jumbo's Japs.
That'd be shuffleboard.
Jumbo's Japs against against Sar. It wasn't Sar because he was gone, but the Baron's Blitzers and stuff like that. But
Jumbo's Japs. And what's this?
I mean, this is Vern Gagne now. So
yeah. Oh yeah.
Now wait, had Vern had his mansion seized yet at this point?
I can't remember the timeline of that one.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
That is the government. That's actually kind of shitty. That the government seized his property via eminent domain to build a park or something.
Yeah. Well, that happens.
Yeah, but it also happened right before he went bankrupt, so he was screwed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he couldn't get the proper market value of the house.
Yeah. Now, also in 1990, there were a lot of like these groups that were trying to start up, you know, trying to get TV deals.
Or they had TV,
and one of them was this group called IWA in Florida, which there were quite a few IWAs in Florida over the years. But this one was started up by Rob Russin, and he got dates at Disney World. This is before WCW ever went there, and had a deal with Sports Channel America for 1 month. And after that month, it could have been renewed for 2 years or completely dropped.
And it was completely dropped.
And it's completely dropped. But they did have the TV tapings on July 28th and drew about 150 fans. And these were some of the matches that took place.
Was this the taping that was at that Paradise Cove place or whatever it was? Okay.
Here's some of your matches.
So I think I've seen this a few times. Yeah.
All right. We have Dean Malenko who was, you know, a Florida regular this time period, but wasn't quite yet the Dean Malenko you would know. Working against Ricky Rice, he worked against Jimmy Backlund on these tapings. Tommy Rogers worked against Jimmy Backlund on
both
these tapings.
At least one of those is on the 1990 yearbook.
Yeah, and Steve Kern worked against Jimmy Backlund. And Jimmy Backlund, of course, is Jimmy Del Rey of the Heavenly Bodies. Then we had Kevin Von Erich come in, and he worked against Larry Cameron, which is a fascinating matchup on paper.
Yeah, we should talk about who Larry Cameron is.
We'll talk about Larry Cameron.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll hit on it. And a heel, Jules Strombo, who Jules Strombo sucked in 1982.
I can only imagine the Frank Hill Jules Strombo, not the original Jules Strombo.
Well, of course not. And then you had Denny Brown against Lou Perez, and Cousin Luke against Jules Strombo, Ivan Koloff against Steve Kern. We had Larry Cameron against Derek Dukes, Larry Cameron against Moondog Spot. Larry Cameron's a guy who was getting looks.
Yeah, this is Babyface Moondog Spot, by the way.
Yeah, Babyface Moondog Spot. Larry Cameron's a guy who got looks from both the major promotions. He was a black guy with big size, you know, not really good in the ring, but imposing figure. But he's a guy that just never really made it. I mean, you saw a lot of Larry Cameron in the day. Why did he not make it?
I don't know. Well, he was old, though. I mean, he was like 40 already at this point.
He was a late bloomer.
He was not a great worker. And he had been in Calgary, and then he worked in, I mean, he was here. He was in Germany a bit.
Japan.
And worked in New Japan. But he really had an amazing presence to him. I mean,
That's what I'm saying.
If you see just photos of him, you don't get it. I mean, it's hard to explain because he seemed like a star more than just about anyone who was not a star at that point.
Yeah, totally. And, Joe, I mean, you look at some of these guys on these tapings, it looks like a lot of junior heavyweight type matches. But, yeah, Dean Malenko's a guy who was really good for a long time but just never got that break. I mean, I guess maybe because he was vanilla, which I'm not, you know, using a pun because of Kevin Nash, but that was basically the way he was perceived, was he was colorless and stuff like that in an era where you had to have charisma.
And he was even short by the standards of short guys at that time.
But you look, I mean, Dean Malenko's the guy, and he worked in Japan a good bit. He's the guy we talk about with Pillman. I mean, if Dean Malenko could have came up sooner, I mean, he could have had a much bigger career too.
Yeah, I just think, there's some good things on this show, it looks like. A lot of them involving Jimmy Backlund, because he's in all the good matches here.
Derek Dukes and Ricky Rice are two guys that I liked back then. I thought Derek Dukes was going to be a guy that could have been a future star. I mean, they were the top guns in AWA. Really good babyface tag team. Young guys, could move around, fly around. And then they just faded away. They were Eddie Sharkey guys, too. So I think they basically just stayed and worked in Minnesota. I know Derek Dukes eventually had this long feud with Charlie Norris and guys like that for Eddie Sharkey. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, two guys just deserve better. They should have went to Memphis. They've been great in Memphis.
Which one took the – did one take a dive against Mark Gasnow?
Derek Dukes, right. Yes.
Oh, wow. I totally forgot about that one.
I was just
going to
mention that next,
there.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Derek Dukes and Mark Gasnow in a boxing match. Wow. But yeah, Kevin Von Erich is the guy that looks out of place on this show because he was no-showing USWA at this time on many occasions. But yeah, here he is working on his startup promotion in television. And what's funny is Lou Perez on this same week was getting a minor push on WCW television.
I have no memory of this.
Because basically what they did was they gave him a win to set him up for facing Arn Anderson for the TV title, and he lost. So it's one of those where you get a win to build you up, and then we'll beat you. And they're pushing him as Al Perez's brother, too.
Nothing like being Al Perez's less talented, less charismatic brother.
Yeah, that says a lot. But another promotion at this time period that was around, but we're having issues, was the NAWA based out of Charlotte, North Carolina, which was George Scott's promotion.
A.K.A. South Atlantic Pro Wrestling.
George Scott shut it down this week. That we're talking about, and it was shut down temporarily as they were going to reopen under the South Atlantic banner on August 17th.
Yeah, I don't think I realized before I had seen this that I forgot that until he said it, that it was technically a different company or something. I thought it was just they just changed the name on TV. I didn't realize there was a break.
Yeah, there was a break. And the reason why, one of the reasons why were given to Dave Meltzer was that people were confused by the acronym. Mm-hmm. They were thinking it was either NWA or AWA, which I don't know. I mean, it is the Carolinas.
Wouldn't that be a positive if people thought your show was the NWA? I mean, AWA, I can see that being a negative.
Well, and the promotion was started in the first place to take advantage of the smaller towns in the Crockett territory that weren't getting wrestling anymore.
And they were employing – Ricky Steamboat was the top guy there. There was also – the Nasty Boys were around there.
Robert Fuller.
And this young guy named Vince Torelli, who had become Ken Shamrock, was there.
Also Matt Bourne.
Matt Bourne was there. So Ricky Steamboat, Matt Bourne was like the big feud at this time. So you can see where people might get confused with NWA. AWA, I have no idea where they got that from.
And then
But Steve Beverly reported to Matt Watch that week, though, that the promotion had already lost $250,000. So there's your
possible
reason. There's your reason why they shut down.
What month did they start?
Started in April or May.
Oh, my God.
I don't understand. Like, are you buying primetime television on NBC? Because I don't understand.
They were paying syndicated. They were paying for television. They were airing down here. I can't remember what station they aired on. No, it was on the other station.
No, but was it maybe a Channel America station or something like that?
No.
So they were just paying for TV time that they shouldn't have.
Yeah, exactly. That's where they went in debt. And that's when a lot of these indies were having problems that way because of that. They were paying way too much for television.
Yeah, for people who don't know, I mean, especially 1990 was kind of the end of people being able to get lots of people being able to get large amounts of wrestling on television. I mean, especially your major metro areas, so New York, Chicago, Atlanta, LA. I mean, you would get tons of, like, here, you know, we had the local sports channel. We would have a block that was USWA, ICW, AWA, I think also maybe IWA. We had, you know, the sports channel. We also got Sports Channel America. So we got UWF and IWA and LPWA. We got, you know, you had the all week, you had the Legends of Wrestling. You had the Big Two shows. If you were in the right part of New York or whatever, you got Galavision. You got CMLL. The different AWA shows. I mean, lots of different. Oh, and ICW, right. I said ICW. Actually, I said ICW already, but you get the idea. And,
it's a lot of television.
And you had the stations. You had your America One, your Channel America, which were. Do you want to explain what those were, or am I better equipped to explain?
Well, America One was later on.
So it was mostly Channel America.
Sports Channel America.
No, Channel America.
No, I'm talking about Sports Channel America. That's what IWA was on.
No.
Channel America didn't come to later on either.
No, I think Channel America was around back then.
I don't remember it.
Maybe you didn't have it, but it was. Channel America was like, man, how do you explain Channel America or America One these days? Because
well, America One, like I said, was around in the mid-90s.
No, I know, but still. But also American Independent Network, those type of things. Like,
late 90s or mid-90s.
I'm trying to explain that to someone who's younger, though. Like, is there even a way to explain low-power TV stations and stuff? Like,
no, not really.
stations that did not have a wide footprint, they would get the programming from these small. I mean, they're kind of like people will refer to like a MeTV or something as a network now. It was sort of like that, but not exactly.
MeTV is a national network, though. That's basically like a sub.
No, I know it is. That's what I'm saying. It's not even.
It's lesser than that.
Most people who watched it were pulling it on a big satellite, though.
Yeah,
they were not watching it on low power.
America One and Channel America were playing a lot of infomercials.
Right.
They didn't have
much original content besides wrestling.
Exactly. So that was way different than MeTV.
And Sports Channel America. Now, did either of you get Sports Channel America?
I did not.
Okay, because that was this thing where it was mostly. It was pretty much. Even though it was supposed to be a national cable network, it was pretty much just the New York area, right?
Yes.
So it was like.
It showed all local sports and stuff like that from New York.
No, but it was supposed to be.
That wasn't on MSG.
No. That was Sports Channel. Sports Channel America, because Sports Channel became Fox Sportsnet. Sports Channel America was their attempt at doing a national thing, but it was still mostly on New York area based cable systems. So you would have, like, there was one point where they got the NHL cable deal, and there was this whole hubbub over it because most people didn't get Sports Channel America, even though it was supposed to be national. And that was also But that Sports Channel America was what the national cable outlet for Herb Abrams UWF.
Yeah. Yeah, so a lot of
yeah, there we go. Herb Abrams UWF too.
So. Wrestling television, you know, was changing completely in 1990. And we'll talk about that even more in just a minute. But first, more legal issues in wrestling. We can't get enough of it. We go to the Pacific Northwest, and we talk about Art Barr, who was working in Northwest's Beetlejuice, which we talked about in the previous show. And he had pled guilty to sexual assault charges on July 27th and was sentenced to 2 years probation, 180 hours community service, and a $1,000 fine, as well as paying restitution to the victim. Right, Barr was accused of raping a 19-year-old girl on the stairwell of the Armory in Pendleton, Oregon, while a show is going on.
I forgot that part.
And even with all this being in local news, the promotion never changed their opinion on Barr and kept him in the Beetlejuice gimmick throughout, working as a fan favorite based to kids. But during this, after this happened, though, they kept him off TV for the week and never mentioned it.
Not only was he a kid's favorite, though, he did a Peter Pan entrance where kids followed him to the ring. Dozens of kids would follow him to the ring.
Now, Joe, Art Barr's a guy who, oh, man, he's another one of these what-if guys. And we talked about this, I guess, on the last show, too. But, I mean, I want to get your opinion of him. You know, he worked Los Gringos Locos in Mexico, Love Machine, was supposed to go to ECW with Eddie before he died. I mean, talk about Art Barr and what you thought about him as a performer.
I mean, yeah, he is one of the great what-ifs because he would have gone to ECW. He had the talent and all the charisma. I imagine what he and Eddie could have done there in New Japan or as, you know, cruiserweight wrestling broke through in WCW, what he could have done there had he gone back. And it's just, you know, it's just a shame. But I mean, he was in WCW like the next month, wasn't he, as the Juicer?
Yeah, he came in WCW around September, October, Halloween Havoc, stuff like that.
Yeah, he only lasted a few months. The Juicer is still one of my favorite.
You can thank the local paper for that. The local Portland paper for that.
Yeah, they pretty much, you know, got him gone. But I think Big Star Barr's a deal where the reason why he didn't, you know, receive further punishment from the promotion is his father, Sandy Barr.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was the referee and promoter as well. And
ran the flea market, rented the building every Tuesday for his flea market.
Yeah, so it's one of those nepotism deals. And, you know, me and you talked about Art Barr on the last show. So, it's just a guy that's a troubled guy. You know, that's all it was. And it was a dark cloud over his life.
The circumstances of the what he said happened always found interesting. That he was like, I thought she... Like, not that that doesn't make it rape, because it still very much makes it rape, but he was like, I thought she was just saying that she'd rather not have sex in the stairwell of an armory as a wrestling show was going on.
Yeah.
I thought that's what she was saying no about. Very weird.
But yeah, it was just a bad situation for everyone involved. All right, moving on to Texas and in Tennessee, because we're now working with Jarrett Promotions, USWA. And a big, big deal happens here as KTVT TV in Dallas, Channel 11.
The Super Ones.
Which aired the two-hour block every Saturday night, which was worth for many years from the Will Rogers Coliseum and Northside Coliseum, but eventually became, you know, matches from the Sportatorium that were taped that morning on Saturday morning.
It became a Memphis-style show, basically.
It became a Memphis-style show. Well, they were dropped from the programming after many years. And what they did was they decided to go with a non-wrestling show from 10 to 11, then replaced them with WWF Superstars from 11 to 12. What's mentioned about this is as recently as 18 months before, they were the highest rated wrestling show in any of the top 10 media markets. But as the promotion style changed, the relationship changed as well, as the station was not happy with the content that was on their television. The issues between Chris and Tony Adams against Steve Austin and Jeannie Clark, which involved them being stripped of clothing numerous times, and Tessa, John Tatum's valet, and later Bill Dundee's valet, also being stripped of her clothing, as well as violence against the women, and Billy Joe Travis unfortunately calling Iceman Parsons the N-word, uncensored on television. Because to explain this, all right, if you know about the snowman angle in Memphis that was being run like a month before this. They ran a similar angle in Dallas, but with Iceman Parsons, where he come in and did this whole deal where they weren't booking him because he was black and all sorts of stuff. So Billy Joe Travis, it was against Jeff Jarrett. So they were doing it against Jarrett, not Lawler. And Billy Joe Travis went to Jeff Jarrett and said, don't worry about that, Ian. You know, so, and it was uncensored. And that got enough complaints from the viewers that, you know, that forced the channel's hand to make their move. But it also didn't hurt that after the WWF's deal with KTVU in San Francisco, which we talked about, fell apart, WWF offered to give KTVT a proper house show percentage, as well as a better weekly fee than what the NWA was offering. Plus, it didn't hurt that WWF had just signed Kerry Von Erich, who debuted that Sunday. Now, Joe, do you watch a lot of USWF in this time period?
Yeah.
That the Adams and the Austin feud was about as raunchy of wrestling television. You know, I mean, people talk about the Attitude Era. This was like one of the pioneering Attitude Eras. I mean, this was some crazy stuff.
Yeah, I remember the Aftermags were really in love with this feud because they'd have a story on it seemingly every month or so. And it was compelling, and I do find it funny that a lot of these things that were just the norm in Memphis got them kicked off TV in Dallas.
Yeah, and the big angle on television that week was Austin had photos of Chris Adams supposedly going out with another woman during that week without his wedding ring on, and they were kissing before leaving arm in arm. Well, Tony Adams comes down, looks at the pictures, and gets upset, demanding Chris come out, which he did. And he said this was all a setup, that he was supposedly meeting with his agent, but when he got there, it was this woman, and she was forcing herself on him. And blah, 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 blah. It was a setup. But Tony didn't believe him and slapped him in the face. So, I mean, it was a big-time soap opera deal. And I said you had a lot of stripping going on. And Jeannie Clark, who has large breasts, was running around with, you know, basically heaving out of her bra. I mean, it was just, like I said, raunchy television.
And it should be pointed out that this all came to a head. I don't think it was the same show as the Iceman angle with the Billy Travis, but the same episode included, because it was the same taping, included the angle where Austin jumped off the top rope onto Tony with a splash while she was covering Chris to stop him from hitting Chris with a splash. And on the same show, John Tatum super kicked Tessa in the back of the head.
Yes, so this is, that was the show that got the complaints.
Wasn't all stuff that happened in Memphis.
Yeah, this happened on one television show. So in 1990, no less. So you got to remember, the people don't know. I mean, a lot of you younger folks do not know what the climate was, even in 1990. I mean, this is the same time period where Two Live Crew had As Nasty As They Want to Be, the album out. And there was a humongous controversy because the album cover was girls in thongs laying on their stomach on bikinis with Two Live Crew, like, sticking their heads in between it or something like
and
that.
And the lyrics of Me So Horny.
This is 1990.
Which got them arrested at live performances Florida, right?
In Florida. So this is like the type of climate that was even going on back then. I mean, this wasn't the 60s and the 50s. This was 1990. So, yeah, just a crazy deal. Now, on that August 3rd deal, that was a situation where we had a head-to-head matchup between USWA and WWF. And USWA, of course, was at the Sportatorium. And WWF was at Reunion Arena, which was Kerry Von Erich's debut. Well, here's the attendances for those shows. USWA drew 1,640, and WWF drew 3,000 people. Now, Reunion Arena is a pretty big building. That's embarrassing. That is totally embarrassing.
We've seen more embarrassing crowds in Reunion Arena.
Yeah.
UWF,
and this is a show where the main event of the USWA show was Sweet Daddy Falcone and Gary Young as Jeff Jarrett and Jerry Lawler. Now, Jerry Lawler had just turned babyface. In Dallas, because he had never been a babyface in Dallas. So that was a pretty big deal. But, that's pretty wild there how that outdrew Kerry's big WF debut.
You could have fit 3,000 in the Sportatorium.
Yeah, you could have fit 3,000 in the Sportatorium. Now, also of note on that night in Dallas was Joe Pedicino makes his debut in the Sportatorium. He's replacing Percy Pringle, who was suspended for his antics against guys like Chris Von Erich and Chris Adams. And Pedicino was there to work with Craig Johnson. Of course, they were friends. And Steve Beverly reported in Matt Watch that there are rumors going around that Joe Pedicino has found some international funding for a new promotion that will feature him and Eddie Gilbert as the heads of the wrestling division. Pedicino told Beverly that he is in some delicate negotiations and he would leave it at that. Beverly asked Joe if he was going to buy out Jerry Jarrett and USWA, and Joe said he isn't interested in the Sportatorium or Dallas at that time. Now, real quick before we get on this, Percy Pringle comes up to Joe Pedicino and asks him, are you Ronnie P. Goss's brother? Which is hilarious.
Wait, is this on TV or in the back?
On TV. On television. I remember that. Now, Bix, talk about Joe Pedicino, the international deal, and all that stuff that was going on this time period.
Really was the perfect week to have Joe on, isn't it? Okay, so I'm trying to remember when they first started giving more details, but this is the beginning of the Global Wrestling Federation. So I guess starting a few months later, I'm guessing when they did the TV tapings in like Nashville and stuff is when you started seeing in the crowd Mr. Olu Oliami of Kangi Sports Entertainment in Nigeria, or Kangi Sports Entertainment Nigeria, which owned the Global Wrestling Federation. And I think that's when they started mentioning the Global Wrestling Federation. But at this point, it's just like Pedicino has a mysterious backer, and he may be buying a promotion or starting a promotion or something. And for months and months, I guess like well into like when? Like the spring of 91? We still thought he had $25 million behind it. So,
yeah.
Eventually, so they do this thing where at the end, because you have to remember when Jarrett then leaves Dallas, for at least for the rest of 1990, he tapes like 3 months worth of TV in like three nights in the Memphis territory. He tapes the world title tournament in Memphis, which was like 6 weeks of TV.
Yeah.
And then, like, I think another, like, 3 or 4 weeks each in Louisville and Nashville, I think.
Yes.
And at the end of... Now, I think he then went back to another taping at one of those, like, in Nashville again, but...
It was January 91 when they came back.
Okay, right. So whichever the last taping was, they do this thing where they find out, and Joe Pedicino, like, celebrates with Craig Johnson because we find out we've been accepted into the Global Wrestling Federation. And then they did this pilot taping, which just aired as the USWA show, where they had Lawler versus Funk. They brought Cactus Jack back. They had One Man Gang. We talked about this earlier. No, Kisano was there for a match. Dragon Master was there. They upgraded the production and stuff. But they had Doc and Gordy in for a match. But it was really just some of those guys were just in for one night. And Scotty the Body was there as Scotty the Body. But it just aired on the USWA syndicated show. Nothing happened. Pedicino gets other backing when it turns out that Olu Oliami was either completely not real or a pre-internet Nigerian scammer.
What a shot, Nigerian scam.
The official story that Scott Hudson and Pedicino's friends tell now is that it was actually a pre-internet Nigerian scam, which I guess I can buy. People back then didn't, Bruce Mitchell, I know, didn't think that think he was scammed, thought he was doing the scamming, but it certainly seems a lot more plausible now than it did then.
Totally.
But eventually he found backing from I forget who were the Overstreets. Exactly.
Ah, man, I can't remember what their deal was.
They were a wealthy family in Atlanta, and they backed Global, but Global downscaled from what it was originally. And then a few months in, they also got rid of most of the fly-in talent, too. And that's
cool. Yeah, the other half of this whole deal is Eddie Gilbert. Now, Joe did an excellent...
More about Global, listen to the podcast that Joe did with me.
An excellent podcast with Dylan Hales about Eddie Gilbert's resurgence starting around this time period after leaving NWA and in the Memphis and all that other stuff.
Excellent podcast that Joe did.
yeah, just tremendous stuff. And Joe, talk, just give a synopsis of Eddie Gilbert of this era.
Well, I think you had mentioned on the last episode that Eddie never really got to show his full heel potential on a national scale. Well, he did on the regional scale. He comes back to Memphis. He has an angle where he agrees to be Bill Dundee's partner, but then doesn't help him out during a brawl and says, well, I agreed to be your tag partner, and that's it. And then that sets up the heel, turns Jerry Lawler back babyface. So it's Lawler and Dundee against Eddie Gilbert, Tony Anthony. He brings his brother in. There are all these, like,
really Sam Lowe.
Yep, Sam Lowe, who he rechristened Sam Baslow. After Sam Bass, who was Jerry Lawler's former manager who died in a car crash in the 70s, which is amazing. And there's just all kinds of hair stretcher matches and hair matches, all these wild brawls. This is the run where Eddie runs Jerry Lawler over with a car in the parking lot.
And drew up the houses. The houses grew as this was going.
Yeah, that's something I couldn't quite. It seemed business was hotter. I didn't have the numbers to confirm it, but we see here the July 30th show drew 3,000 people, which is.
Yeah, because they were not drawing, but like sometimes around 2,000, something like that. So, yeah.
And the title tournament drew too?
Yeah.
Yep. They had a special, I think it was a 21-man one-night tournament, 17 matches for the vacant title.
Yeah, because Snowman had to vacate his title because of injury.
On the Dallas show, on the national show, it was because of an injury that will keep him from wrestling for 30 days. On the shows in the Memphis territory, it was Eddie Marlin going on TV and saying he might have won the belt for crack.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that one. He really was hurt. Or something happened. He could have been faking an injury. I don't know. He was maybe trying to get out of a job.
Yes, also
job to Brian Lee or something like that.
Yeah. By the way, the running Lawler over with the car angle, as weird as it sounds because of everything ESPN did with censoring Global, they did a USWA Year in Review show on ESPN at the end of the year. They included Memphis clips, and they showed the running at Lawler over angle on ESPN.
Yeah, totally. And you look at that, that stuff, and Sam Lowe's a guy, it's Eddie's friend, John Gillian. And everywhere Eddie went.
No, Sam Lowe's a different guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I thought John Gillian. John Gillian, I know he did stuff in Continental and later ECW, but Sam Lowe is just kind of another one of Eddie's friends who was on car trips.
Oh, okay. Well, I stand corrected. Wow. Okay. Thank you. Because I had totally thought that they were the same guy.
No, they actually brought John Gilliam out to do a head shaving thing before a hair match. It's just kind of a demonstration. So he was around, but Sam Lowe is a different guy.
Yeah. And also, and on the Memphis side of things, real quick though, talk about the Lawler babyface deal. The first night turned babyface, he got DQ'd for using a chain, and then pile drive referee Tony Falcon got suspended. So what a babyface he was. I guess he was like, Austin before Austin in some way, even though Austin was there.
I remember that match vividly, though, from the Dallas show, where it's like him, like it's late in the match, and him and Jarrett both take change out of their boots. Oh, no, Lawler has two chains, one in each boot.
Yes.
And he throws one to Jarrett, and then on commentary, he's like, oh, this is the Craig Johnson's like, this is the Jerry Lawler we know. It's just awesome. That was the moment that I became a Jerry Lawler fan, I think.
You gotta love the Memphis chain. I mean, babyfaces used it, heels used it. It was just a staple in Memphis wrestling history. But in the Memphis TV show on July 28th, Cowabunga, which is Chris Champion working as a Ninja Turtle, and at this time Ninja Turtles were very big, was doing a karate demonstration when the Wild Things, I play out the Tone Loke song, Scott Braddock and Jeff Gaylord ran out, which them running must have been fun to watch. And they broke the boards over Cowabunga's head. But in a funny side note, before the attack, one of the boards Cowabunga was trying to break broke early. So, yeah, it tells you how tough those boards were. But Chris Champion, we talked about Art Barr. Chris Champion is another guy that had a lot of problems. But Joe, Chris Champion, a troubled guy, worked many various gimmicks over the years, but this was like some of his best work in the era, working as Chris Champion before and then coming as Cowabunga. Talk about Chris Champion, what you thought about him as a worker.
He was good for the time. He had a TV match with Eddie Gilbert around this time that was actually quite enjoyable.
I love that match.
Here.
It's because it's
yes.
He's wearing the turtle costume, but doing like regular Memphis babyface shtick, and it's just very weird to watch. But awesome.
It is, yeah. Seeing grown men beat up a Ninja Turtle is always very, very curious sight. But between Cowabunga and
the Wild
Things.
Well, he's also a teenager, too. I mean, he's a teenager.
I guess that's
Ninja
true,
Turtle.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, I mean, well, it's Memphis. They do a lot of bad things to teenagers there.
But between Cowabunga and the Wild Things, this is a very 1990s segment.
Oh, yeah. Memphis was totally, you know, definitely hooked in the pop culture at the time. There's
yeah,
a lot,
they had MC
lot of
Jammer running around at
MC
this time.
MC Jammer.
As well.
You know, we talked about Headbanger Ed on the last show.
Lawler trying to be with the neon tights.
Yeah, Lawler and his different neon colors. Jeff Jarrett with his color. I mean, yeah, and they try to change the look of the television.
Even
the lighting.
Even the year before, Ronnie P. Gossett is the Joker.
Yeah, Ronnie P. Gossett did this Joker. I mean, yeah, they were definitely into it. And 1990 Memphis Television is a blast. I mean, it's really fun to watch. And I know Joe watched a lot of it, you know, and on the Eddie Gilbert show. And it's on YouTube. So definitely check that out for sure. And, yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong with that type of stuff.
Nope.
But moving on to another fledgling promotion called the WWA. Now, this was run by the Putskis, Ivan and his wife Patricia.
Oh, wait, no, wait. Is this the promotion where Booker T and Stevie Ray started?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they were taping television in Sam Houston Coliseum, the old building where Paul Bosch promoted.
Good, I didn't know
And they were bringing in all a lot of big-name talent. I mean, Terry Taylor worked there. Dr. Death worked there. Gordy worked there. The Guerreros. Paul Orndorff worked there before he went back to NWA. They were bringing Kamala in. They were bringing all these named guys. Well, they had to cancel their TV taping that scheduled on August the 3rd because they were trying – because as they were paying for television, they couldn't afford it anymore. So they were trying to convince the station they were on in Houston to pay for the TV time. And that station knew what the game was because, you know, these other stations weren't paying for wrestling anymore. I mean, weren't getting paid for wrestling anymore. So they said no. And basically the promotion died. So another wrestling television story of 1990. So that's a common theme here. Now, in a random deal, and for some, you know, bumfuck promotion somewhere, Ricky Itake, who's a longtime Southern California wrestler, job guy on WWF television whenever they came through, and a guy named Louis Spicoli, who, of course, we would know later on down the line, and ECW and WCW, and worked as Rad Radford, and, of course, another guy that died way too early.
But also was doing jobs on WWF TV.
And also doing jobs on WWF television when they came through the West Coast. They had a match in Bullhead City, Arizona.
Oh, so I'm sure this was a Stevie Airwolf show. It must have been.
Well, who knows? But anyway, Itake dropkicked Louis through a glass door. And then they brawled into a river before Itake used a rock that he had found on the beach to knock Spicoli out and pin him. Now, Joe, wrestling and rivers, there was I know Joel Goodhart had that deal where, was it Hansen?
Well, that was Larry Sharp Dennis Corluzzo shows, yeah.
The Corluzzo shows. Was it Stan Hansen and who?
Terry Funk.
Terry Funk that went into a river. I mean, you can't get enough of wrestling shows in bodies of water, can you?
I guess not. I'm trying to think. I think Hardcore Holly and Al Snow ended up near a river.
Well, WWF used to do one like every time they went to Bridgeport, somebody ended up in the water.
Now WWF, every time they go to, where is it that they do the Gulf? Oh, El Paso that they do the Gulf of Mexico?
South Padre Island.
Oh, no, South Padre. No, where is it that they do, which city is it that they do the Gulf of Mexico angles in now?
Port Arthur, maybe?
No, but it's somewhere they tape TV, though. You know where I'm talking about.
But they haven't done that in years, though. It's
been
a while.
They did one pretty recently, did they? Like 2 years ago?
Yeah, but they
did. It was, whatchamacallit? Sandow and Cody Rhodes was the last one, I think. So,
but anyway, you got glass doors, you got rivers, you got rocks. I mean, this ECW was later on, but shit, you had all this stuff going on before then. I mean, this is nothing new. I mean, and those indies were crazy back in the day. Some of these little small groups that worked around. They're trying to, you know, make their niche.
Was Slammers around then?
I don't think so.
Because Slammers, for people who don't know, was in Southern California, and they would try to get by putting like ads for videotapes with really bloody photos in the magazines. Like, that was how they tried to make their name.
Yeah. Well, moving on to the last major promotion of the night, the National Wrestling Alliance. And the big news story of this week is Jim Herd, the notorious boss of the NWA at this time, gave an interview to Wade Keller for Torch Talk.
And this was the second newsletter interview in a few weeks, too. He had done one for Matt Watch a few weeks earlier, too.
Yeah, he did one with Steve Beverly. But this one had kind of like a different edge to it. Mainly because Steve Beverly was working for the NWA at the time.
And was one of the few guys that got along well with Jim Herd.
Yeah, and got along with Jim Herd because they had a lot in common as far as, you know, television. So anyway, these are some of the things that Herd talked about. He said his main goal for the NWA was to supply TBS with 4 hours of wrestling with ratings that would meet their standards. And it has, as they are the highest rated show on the network. He also said that he wanted to make the promotion profitable. He admitted that it hasn't been always that way, saying that the venues have been injured by the amount of stuff they have been put on television, such as 4 Clash of the Champions per year, 5 pay-per-views, etc., etc. Herd said that they must maintain a high-energy TV product and keep that injury going on house shows without using all the same talent. His main goal is supply high ratings. But then he talks about how the house shows have been injured by television. What do you do?
I think you better pick one or the other, whether you want to be profitable or make your emphasis high-rated television.
I think that's a little unfair, but...
Well,
I think, though, as you've seen how they would go from television, though, is if you remember, in 89 and going into the first part of 1990... There were not a lot of like job TV matches on their television. They had, fairly big names working, fairly big names.
Weren't hot-shotting either.
Basically when Ole took over, it's when that whole thing changed. It went to more of the jobber stuff, like, World Championship Wrestling used to be, where you would have all these short matches on television where they were trying to build up the house shows. Problem was, house show business wasn't going up either. So, I mean, you're trying to serve two masters, but I think, if you're creative enough, which Ole Anderson and creativity was an oxymoron, but if you're creative enough, you can make it work, Vix. I mean, we've seen, WCW and WWF over the years, have strong television and strong house shows at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, look at it. Yeah, I mean, it's not like wrestling doing big TV ratings was dependent on big-name matches across the show for years and years. I mean, I think as long as you have one or two, I think you have good job guys and good wrestlers and good promos and, a couple matches atop the TV shows, especially if it's a two-hour show, I don't think you need to do competitive matches across the show in that era, although, I mean... See, for me, it's weird. Especially at this point where you're not hitting weekly towns, I don't remember ever being that much, at least, I'm younger then, but still, I don't ever remember thinking that much, especially the type of, the type of cycle they were running house shows on, where a certain match necessarily was more important than going to see live wrestling. Some cases it was, and some it wasn't, but... I think as long as you're protecting the real money drawing matches, I don't think it matters.
Yeah, totally. And you just gotta know what you're doing as far as booking. And at this time, it was, they had a focused product, but it wasn't really that great. Put it that way, it was starting to go down, especially as 1990 went on. But moving on to other topics, he was asked about Ricky Steamboat and his departure.
Which we talked about last time.
Which we talked about in the last show. And Hurd admitted said there was no animosity from him towards Ricky, and that they just couldn't come to terms on the deal. Hurd said the split was amicable, and said that he had no issues with Ricky wanting to come back, and the deal would be waiting on him if he wanted to. Hurd was then asked if the issues were money-related, and Hurd said, not really. It just came back that Ricky wanted to work a limited schedule, and it was a request that would have been hard to fill. Hurd was also asked about Tully Blanchard and the issues with him coming in earlier in the year, and he said they were basically competing with Coca-Cola for his services, and Tully was leaning more towards going to them, so they broke off contract talks. Tully, though, ended up not getting that job either. And Hurd, yeah, exactly. He was fighting for two jobs and got neither of them.
Coke or Coca-Cola?
I was going to say, when I'm hearing that for a second, I'm like, is he making a really bad taste joke because of why they didn't hire him?
No, he was working. No, Tully was. Here's the deal. Tully was supposed to go to work with Coca-Cola as kind of like the job that Dick Murdoch had with Coors. Yeah,
that's a really weird fit.
Yeah, I mean, he was going to be like a brand ambassador, I guess, or going around trying to sell,
I guess,
or stuff like that.
I wonder if he would have done the speeches like Ric Flair does now.
Yeah, so that's basically what he was going to do. Well, you know, Hurd was asked if there was any chance of Tully coming in now. He said, well, that's up to Ole Anderson. Now, Joe, regarding Steamboat, I mean, he eventually came back at when Hurd was still boss in 1991, but we've heard over the years, and Ric Flair has talked about this, how Steamboat's wife, Bonnie, was a major hindrance towards Ricky's career. You know, basically want him to be at home. And there's other wrestlers over the years that had this issue, too. Jason Cross around here in Georgia is one of the big examples. But, I mean, and Ricky was working around the Charlotte area, of course, we talked about for George Scott. But I think Ricky Steamboat coming back in 1990 could have been a really good deal for them because they needed somebody bad
absolutely
reinvigorate that product.
They certainly did. And it's funny, before he came back, he went to the WWF, and the only reason he left is because they didn't like how they were booking him. So I don't know quite if that says he went to WCW as a last option, but they certainly could have used him in 1990 given some of the upper-level babyfaces they were trotting out there. So.
Yeah, I mean, Sting and Luger were you know, of course, the top guys and the Steiners. But after that, you had JYD and Tommy Rich. Tommy Rich was having a good year, though. And Pillman was languishing low on the cards. Paul Orndorff was there, but not for long. So they needed that extra baby face that could have come in. And, yeah, you look at Steamboat, you know, reuniting his feud with Flair or feuding with Arn Anderson. Or even Stan Hansen, who was coming in. Steve Owen Hansen, if you would have been awesome. But going to Tully, Vix, I mean, reading the 1990 newsletters, you know, or even after he got fired from WWF in 89, Tully was always linked to NWA. I mean, even to this July period. And it was either money-related or drug test-related or whatever it was, but he's another guy who, if he would have come back, man, I mean, think about the Horsemen with Flair, Arn, Tully, and Windham back together again.
Yeah, and you know what's weird or interesting, I guess, about the whole thing with WCW not taking him after they found out about the drug test, which has always been an interesting story into itself as to how the test got out, but the WWF drug test. Jim Cornette's version of this that's in the Midnight Express scrapbook is that when he made the deal with Tully and Arn, and then reneged on it because they found out about Tully failing the WWF drug test for cocaine, and then decided not to sign Tully after they had verbally agreed to it, and then also to lower Arn's pay because his value had allegedly gone down. Cornette says that ended up making it being a reason why a lot of wrestlers did not go to WCW, at least while Hurd was there, that they felt that they couldn't trust him in deals.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. We're on the contract.
Oh, yeah, so where were we, though? So, yeah, Tully, because the Horsemen kind of fizzled. I mean, then they brought Sid in and stuff, but the whole Horsemen thing was just weird in 1990.
You had Ole there for a while. You had Minnesota Records.
We have Sting, too. Right, it's Ole, so you have Ole and Arn come back to join up with Sting and Flair. They turn on Sting. Then
Tully was in the building for that turn. He was supposed to be part of it.
Oh, I forgot about that part. Yes.
He was there. He was supposed to be out there. And they could not come to terms on a contract.
So they were actually, at that point, they were okay with signing him.
Yeah, they wanted him.
Just a few weeks after they had decided they didn't.
Yeah.
And then, then Ollie and Arn both get hurt. Ollie retires. They bring in Enos and Bloom as the Minnesota Wrecking Crew 2.
Oh, so Arn's injured.
Right, Arn's injured too. Then
Wyndham comes in.
I love the trade to get the Destruction Crew. They gave the AWA a Pillman Flair match.
Yeah, which did pretty good for them business wise too.
Yes,
but they bring in Wyndham for Capital Combat.
They bring in Wyndham.
Sid joins in. But Sid was a guy who he would rarely appear with a horseman. It was weird that dynamic.
Except to wear his tuxedo.
Yeah, it was just a weird dynamic there. But, totally definitely could have been, another welcomed asset to that promotion.
And Sid even had stuff separate from the Horsemen. He had the Stan Hansen tag team while he was still in the Horsemen.
And the reforming the Skyscrapers with Dan Spivey.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it was just a weird deal. But anyway, moving on, talk about more weird deals with Jim Herd. He was asked about the Ding Dongs and RoboCop and how they flopped. And he said that he tries to walk the fine line of appealing to the hardcore fans and the casual fans, especially the teenagers. Hurst said he knew there would be criticism, but he could take the heat because he believes in free enterprise and saying what was on your mind. Hurst said it's very tough to satisfy both audiences without trying to alienate either one of them, but he knows that his wrestling product is far superior to WWF's. Regarding Ding Dongs, he said they weren't introduced properly and were supposed to have this huge bell in the corner where they could ring it to become energized, but that deal fell apart. And then he was asked about the work rate issue, and he said that his performers must be able to wrestle first before they have a character, but admitted it's tough these days with the training grounds drying up. So they're going to train guys themselves at times.
And
now, Joe.
Well, the power plant opened the next year, right? I mean,
yeah.
Not as a public school, but as, yeah.
Yeah, but Joe, the first guy who comes to mind when they talk about training guys themselves is Kevin Nash. So that's not a ringing endorsement. But
there are two of them. There was one before him. Elegante.
Who?
Elegante. I was trying to deal with the Dusty Elegante.
That was David Sierra. David Sierra was basically the guy that was training him.
Did he bring them to... No, but he came in through WCW, though, because he was signed to the Hawks.
Yeah. I guess you could say that. But Ding Dongs. I mean, talk about the absurdness of that gimmick.
Yeah, I like how you have to try to appeal to teenagers through guys with the bell gimmick, and the only thing stopping them was they didn't have a huge bell to get energized, whatever that means.
I found that fascinating because, I mean, you think companies don't know what teenagers like now? Look how it was 25 years ago.
Yeah.
That's what they think teenagers would like.
God. I mean, I can see teenagers like RoboCop, but not,
maybe.
Not in a neutered wrestling context.
And the deal was that, I mean, they had the little bells on their feet and their boots.
Yeah.
And it's Greg Evans and Richard Sartain, who were local wrestlers from working with Joe Hamilton's Deep South promotion. And they were pretty good little hands, but they had no chance. They were dead in the water. And like the ultimate Ding Dongs match is when they worked against the Skyscrapers. And Sid and Dan Spivey just destroyed those guys and ripped their mask off. And then put their mask on their heads. So that's the definitive Ding Dongs match. But RoboCop, Capital Combat 90 was built around RoboCop, and all he did was just walk out there. So Joe, I mean,
and he probably broke Sting out of the cage that the Horsemen had locked him.
Yeah, but Joe, I mean, RoboCop's pretty damn hokey, wasn't it?
Yeah, like why didn't he help Sting more? It's just he just came out and ripped the cage off, and then he just left. I guess he figured his job was done. No, that was just really. It's not what fans want to see at that time, and I know the talk of appealing to a casual audience, but no one wanted to see that at all.
Well, it didn't help RoboCop's cause that it was really Peter Weller in the costume, and he's shorter than Sting.
Mm.
Oh, I didn't know that it really was Peter Weller.
It really was Peter Weller, yeah, and he was shorter than Sting. So that's not a good look when you're trying to build this super character. But talk about. Joe, talk about the work rate differences between – I mean, Herd's right. I mean, as a wrestling product, WCW and NWA was far superior to WWF this time period.
No, absolutely. If you just – I mean, the level of talent you had, I mean, you know, you had Flair and Pillman and, you know, the Steiners, the Midnight Express for a little bit more, and
Southern Boys.
Southern Boys, and just
Arn, you know, Anderson.
Arn Anderson.
Even like, Tom Zenk.
Brad Armstrong.
Yeah. Buddy Landell. Rip Rogers. Moondog Spot. Moondog Rex, I mean. Dutch Mantel.
Yeah, their low card was really, really good. Their low card could have been a strong territory.
It was weirdly stacked at this point, yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, Wendell Cooley was doing shots for them at this time period, too. Horowitz was in.
Hector Guerrero wasn't even on TV, and he was a regular on house shows.
Yeah, Ivan Koloff was doing some shots for them at this time, too. So, I mean, it was an interesting promotion, and they had a lot of good workers. So, he was right about that.
By the way, was Hector Guerrero ever on TV, or was he entirely on house shows?
He did work a TV taping. I think he did get one TV match.
Okay.
But Herb was then asked about more about WWF. He asked about working with a regional promotion. And he said that you can never say never. And they try to have friendly relationships with them, unlike Vincent Mann, who wants to kill every wrestling organization that isn't his. Herb said that he doesn't think that will ever happen, though. Or was he wrong? And Herb was then asked about the rumors about NWA trying to buy out the AWA or USWA. And he said, that's not true. They have worked with Vern Gagne this year, which we talked about, and they talk to Jerry Jarrett all the time, and where they could work together on a regional basis. Hurst said that Turner, though, doesn't like having partners in their company and doesn't need them, but they like to keep their options open. He said, though, that they were currently talking to Don Owens in Portland about getting some talent there. Well, okay, Jerry Jarrett, I talked about this on one show. I can't remember which one exactly, but Jerry Jarrett was offered the head booking job before Lee Anderson was hired, and he turned it down. So that's the deal there.
Enough companies to worry about.
Yeah. Don Owens, the deal with that is that, and we talked about this earlier with Beetlejuice, was they brought in Art Barr, and they brought in Jeff Warner to work as J.W. Storm. So they were bringing in guys from the Northwest. They brought in Scotty the Body for a tryout, and it didn't work. But, I mean, they were bringing in those guys. But, yeah, I mean, you look at the NWA in that era, I think that working with a regional territory big, that would have been beneficial towards them.
Yeah, and Portland might have been the best one, because they could have maybe helped prop it up. I mean, maybe, I don't know if they would have had a full enough schedule because I don't know if Memphis would have fit. Although, if Jarrett kept up two different promotions, but they probably would have wanted someone that didn't have national TV, and Jarrett sort of did, at least for Dallas.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't have worked. NWA said national television too.
Right, so it would have really been Don Owen or WWC, I guess.
Yeah, so yeah, that would have been an interesting setup.
And anyway, I was thinking, I forget what I was going to say. Oh, with the AWA though, well, it should be pointed out, as far as them buying the AWA or the USWA, Jerry Jarrett was trying to buy the AWA.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was all
and
these...
And really right around this time, right?
Yeah, there was all kind of power play negotiations going on, of course, which none of them come to pass. But, yeah, that was all, you know, everybody's for sale for the right price. That's what it comes down to. But Herb was then asked about its portrayal in the newsletters, and Herb said that Dave Meltzer's been ragging him for over a year, which he understands, and he even had a good conversation with Dave at the Bash pay-per-view in Baltimore. Herb said again, though, that people can say what they want, and he didn't care. But they serve a purpose for the hardcore wrestling fans, and he wished them success. And then Herd closed
well,
out.
Obviously. He's doing two interviews with them.
Exactly. Yeah, that's pretty funny. Herd was then asked about the racial angles and comments that were going on their TV a couple months ago. And he said he got some phone calls, but it was nowhere near the level of Terry Funk and the plastic bag from the previous year. Herd said he thinks that most wrestling fans know his tongue-in-cheek, and said it's no different than Sapphire kissing some shoes on WF television or Rick Rude shaking his hips over a young lady that laying on her back. Herb thinks NWA gets a raw deal because WWF doesn't get such criticism. Now, there is some truth to that, nobody really talks about. Well, they do now, but WWF was not talked about a lot for the stuff they did back then. You know, when we talk about the, you know, Piper deal and Sapphire and all these different angles. But yeah, I mean, WCW had, that was a, what we're talking about with WCW and the racial angle was that was a deal with Thunderbolt Patterson and Rocky King, and there was some really racially charged type angles going on Bix elaborated on that whole situation.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm pretty sure this is on YouTube. Rocky King was sort of getting a push, but not really for the first time ever, but it was like, and he got involved with the Horsemen, and, you know, it was Shine My Shoes type stuff from Flair and Oli, and Calling Him Boy, I believe, and that type of stuff, and Thunderbolt Patterson tried to come to his assistance, but not really, and Thunderbolt Patterson couldn't do anything, and
JYD was...
And then JYD was the one who actually made the save, and it was just very weird and unnecessarily racially charged, but he did have a legitimate point, though, that WCW was more overt, but he's probably right that WWF being a northern promotion,
I think,
probably got looked over a little more when they did stuff like that. Yeah, I agree.
Totally. Now, Joe, when it comes to the newsletters, what do you expect? If you're doing a shitty job, you're going to get railed on by guys like Dave Meltzer. That comes with the territory.
Yeah, but given what Hurt said about the ding-dongs, he probably in his mind thought he was doing a fine job, and he was just being savaged by the media because that's what they do, and not because he was not doing a good job as the head of WCW.
Well, here's the thing, though, about Hurt is it only gets worse later on, you know, which I'm sure we'll talk about on future shows. So, I mean, right now, they're actually in a transition period from when they had a really strong full year of June 89 until May, June 90. It's pretty strong. And then Oli takes over.
At least from a critical point of view.
Yeah, from a critical point of view. And Oli takes over and things start going downhill. So, yeah, I mean, it's about to come to a head soon. But anyway, on to other non-Jim Herd Torch Talk stuff. There's serious talks going around that the days of the guaranteed contracts will end once Ric Flair, Lex Luger, and Sting's contracts expire. Guaranteed money is one of the main reasons why wrestlers want to work in NWA in the first place, so changing that may force a lot of movement. Dave Meltzer predicted that a lot of younger and greener guys will be coming in, and boy, was he right. Which we talked about, you know, with Maximum Overdrive, the Master Blasters, the Motor City Madman, Big Cat, the Night Stalker. Those are the prime examples of what happens when you let guys like the Midnight Express, you know, when you let Stan Lane leave, and you let other guys leave like Norman or the Samoans.
They drove Norman out. I mean,
they drove Norman out of there. Cactus Jack, Bam Bam Bigelow. I mean, the talent, you look at the talent roster from even as late as April and May, compared to the talent roster of December 1990. And you can see the stark contrast, especially in the low card. So, and what's funny about this, Joe, is the days of the guaranteed contracts are coming to an end. Mm-hmm. Boy, was that wrong. Ask Scott Hall and Kevin Nash about that one, eh?
Yeah, they would continue to be the hallmark of WCW until the very end. So
they are the only guys you can ask. Ask Swole. Ask 4x4. Ask, I mean, everyone.
Well, Hulk Hogan. Okay. Hulk Hogan was like the first one when he came in.
But he did get a percentage too. Hogan got a guaranteed cut, and he got a giant percentage of the pay per views.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's funny how we have this situation in 1990. That's everyone about it then. Boy, it's coming. Another, again, something that's coming to a head very soon, too. And more in NWA television news, they announced that they have finally signed a deal with WGN Chicago to start airing programming on September 15th, which was the NWA pro show, but with different commentary from Tony Schiavone. And I know Jack Brickhouse was part of it. And eventually, Larry Zbysko would become the color announcer. But, the thing about this is, this has been talked about for months, and WGN have been denying it heavily. Like they said, we have no interest in wrestling, and then the deal gets signed. So, and we've seen that lately from other television outlets too, denying they were any part of wrestling, and then eventually taking wrestling on. So that's funny.
You know what's one of the funny things about the WDN show and also the WPIX show, which was similar, which had the custom
the same deal.
Yeah.
if you try to get tapes of Pro from that period, even though the syndicated show you would think theoretically was available in more places, because we're talking about WPIX and WGN, which were superstations, it's much easier to find the New York and Chicago versions.
Yeah, and as I said, the New York version was Jim Ross and Paul Lee on the commentary,
who were great together, and the show did really again. And the show did really good ratings too.
Yeah, and the version of Pro that I watched was WGN's, because it came on every Saturday morning around 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock. So that was, you know, I able to watch that there, and of course the regular Pro show was Lance Russell. And I guess the Freebirds were still there with him as an
yes, it was Lance Russell and the Freebirds, which I wish I've seen more, could see more of.
Yeah, and I think one of our tape trading buddies who has a complete run of television from this era, his version of Pro is that version.
Is the syndicated version?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. You have to message me or tell me after who we're talking about, because I've never seen anyone with a full run of that.
Well, let's just say he has quite the tape collection.
The guy who lives in the same state as me does not. It has mostly as Chicago and New York.
Not from the I guess maybe the era after that deal was set up. But the era I have is from the local Pittsburgh station.
Okay.
But anyway, on to other notes. Dustin Rhodes. Dustin Rhodes is supposed to show up. And, in fact, the plan was to put him against Ric Flair at Halloween Havoc. And they shot an angle that aired on television where Jim Ross, on the July 28th episode of World Championship Wrestling, shows this picture to Arn Anderson and asking him, does the name Dustin mean anything to you? And Arn Anderson just shakes it off like, no. So Dustin eventually goes to work for WWF instead and signs that week. Now, Joe, you know, Dustin eventually showed up in January, but how interesting would a Ric Flair-Dustin Rhodes feud been in 1990?
That would have been very interesting. I wonder if it would have been just too much too soon to come in instantly and work with Ric Flair on a pay-per-view. Because when he came into WCW, he really worked his way up pretty slowly, you know.
Just even although all the news, even though everyone in the newsletters pretended he didn't.
But the thing and the differences between that and then, though, is his father wasn't booking.
True.
So you couldn't.
He really didn't get a giant push, though. I mean, it's really.
Of course not. But I'm saying that's what I think Dusty did on purpose too, so people wouldn't think that he was pushing him because he was his son.
And they still did.
And they still did. But you look at 1990; they couldn't use that excuse because Dusty wasn't there. They were really trying to push him to be just because. And it's a natural feud anyway: Flair versus Rhodes. Mm. But yeah, I think that would have been totally interesting. And Dustin in 1990 was a good worker. I mean, he wasn't what he would become the year or two later, but he was on his way. And then you look at what he did in WWF, and yeah, he was involved in the DiBiase angle, but he did pretty much nothing there. So, other than, you know, Blade for DiBiase on Saturday Night's Main Event, and had that Royal Rumble match.
Well, no, he had the 10-minute match with DiBiase, too.
Yeah, but just again, it's very, very low profile.
Oh, Dylan's going to be angry, do you know?
What do you mean? I mean, like I said, where it was, his WWF run was low profile.
That was like a sweeps week angle, though, wasn't it? Wasn't that like a November angle?
Still low profile. DiBiase was a mid-card heel at that time.
Yeah.
And I mean, it wasn't like he was going against Mr. Perfect, you know, or Gala, or Sergeant Slaughter, so, or, you know, Savage. Hmm. But anyway, talking about mid-carders, Terry Taylor's announcement's coming in. On the Clash of the Champions.
Speaking of mid-card, that was a good one.
After he returned from his All Japan tour on July 28th, which the reason why he was basically going to All Japan because he couldn't work anywhere else after he quit WWF because he's still in the contract. And there was this, you know, threats of lawsuits and all this other stuff. But basically, Terry Taylor's debut match in NWA was teaming up with Jackie Fulton to face the Nasty Boys, who were, I think, making their debut on that show, too. The reason why he had a team with Jackie Fulton because Bobby Fulton was working for All Japan with Tommy Rogers. So, Joe, Terry Taylor's a guy who, I mean, God, he had a pretty damn good run there for, I'd say, 4 years, 84 to 87. Goes to WWF as Red Rooster, comes back here and has a decent run at the end of 1990, going to 91, becomes the Taylor-made man, or Terrence Taylor, then Taylor-made man. But he's a guy that, man, he lost it. I guess Red Rooster killed him.
Yeah, the Red Rooster. I mean, He had some good series of matches with Arne Anderson for the TV title.
And, oh yeah, and Z-Man.
Yeah, and the Z-Man, and the the gimmick was okay. But yeah, he was never quite what he used to be. But he's apparently still he's doing okay. Right? I don't know if he's employed with WWE.
NXT. He is the NXT coach that works with guys who are about to go to the main roster, theoretically.
Yeah, so he's. You know, did all right for himself, so.
Yeah, he's had a career in wrestling, forever. I mean, in creative and working as an office guy. So, yeah. But Biggs, I mean, the Terry Taylor of 1985, 86, compared to Terry Taylor of 1990, again, just totally different people.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if maybe he should have stayed a babyface. I mean, he was a babyface here when he came in, but...
He was a good heel, though.
He was a good
heel. Really good heel.
I mean, he was a really good heel, but... I don't know. I almost wonder if, like, whatever the Red Rooster cost him was more of an issue if he's a heel because you're not taking him as seriously, so he's less of a threat. I mean, I guess that... You know what I mean? Like...
Yeah. Oh, no. It was a stigma on his career. I mean, right. he never really got over that gimmick. If fans were chanting Rooster at him and all this other stuff, he just...
How do you think he could have done in Smoky Mountain if Cornette had been able to get him, which he wanted to, as top babyface?
I think he would have been pretty damn good in Smoky Mountain, actually. I think it would have worked out well. That's an interesting what if, too.
Because it was him and Brad Armstrong were his dream top baby faces, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he never got Brad until 1995.
Yeah.
Towards the end, which is an interesting side note.
And Taylor, honestly, probably a better pick, even though we didn't get to see how it turned out, because he was much better promo than Brad. Not that Brad was an underrated promo, but Taylor was a better promo than Brad.
Yeah. Now, this week, they also announced that Starrcade 90 would take place at the Bayfront Center, St. Petersburg, Florida, on December 15th. Well, that didn't happen. They moved it to St. Louis. Bix, do you remember why they moved it?
No.
I don't remember either. Maybe it has something to do with the Bruiser tie-in, or maybe it's because they went to the Sam Mushnick Memorial Tournament.
Oh, well, no, Pat O'Connor.
Pat O'Connor, that's right.
But yeah, but they did use Dick the Bruiser. And
had Sam Mushnick there. So he was at the show.
Mm.
So,
it was probably a better show for being in St. Louis.
Yeah.
Because the crowd was hot. They were into, they were into guys like Chris Adams, who had been big in the city. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. Now, again, regarding Tully Blanchard, real quick side note, he's really not interested in coming back to wrestling right now because he's now become a preacher. And that was a deal where he was quite a few years there and was pretty successful in it. In fact, when he went back to ECW, that's what he was still doing, which was an interesting side note because ECW at that time was pretty raunchy, starting to get in that era of, what they would become, as time went on, 1995, but... Again, we were talking about Tully Blanchard a lot earlier.
Successful
so
financially or at converting people?
Maybe I'd say both. I mean, I remember hearing stories about, he would come out in North Georgia and he drew pretty good houses at churches. I mean, he was successful.
Who do you work with on top?
Who you work with on top? The Great Mephisto. the television of the week. The highlights were on World Championship Wrestling, other than the picture of Dustin, was Brad Armstrong and Tim Horner not working as Lightning Express, and this is Candyman Brad Armstrong, against Arn Anderson and Barry Windham, which Meltzer gave it 3 stars. But the big angle of the match was that they had this beatdown going on, Sting and the Steiners, and JYD was involved. But Lex Luger comes running out with his clothes torn and tattered, and Jim Ross was going completely nuts about it after Tommy Rich had come over there and told Jim Ross, "They got him, Jim! They got him!" And I remember, I never forget that. It was so hilarious, Tommy Rich saying that, and then Tommy Rich's voice. And the angle continued as Luger would just show up during all the Horsemen matches, just standing in the aisle with his arms crossed, and it was driving Ric Flair crazy, which that was setting up the Luger-Flair U.S. title deal at the Clash. But this is the Dudes with Attitudes era WCW. Joe, I mean, that was just I don't know. I like the dude's attitude set up. I just wish they would have had some better guys in that spot.
Yeah, but, Well, the match you referenced, the Armstrong Horner against the Horseman, it's on YouTube. I watched it today. It is quite a lot of fun. It's definitely worth a watch. And, yeah, I mean, Sting and Luger, great up top. And then when you're hitting JYD and Elegante and Paul Orndorff, it certainly peters off a bit. So,
well, you look at Lex Luger at this time period. He had just come off of the two pay-per-view matches with Flair. And he should have won the title, but that was a whole nother setup.
And there was also was it St. Louis or Chicago?
Chicago, both cities, actually.
Was supposed to win the title. And then
supposed
didn't.
To win the title. Then you had, he was eventually programmed by El Gigante. And, I got to meet Mark, excuse me. And, wow, what a difference there. And then he was going to be programmed with Sid, but then they hired Stan Hansen and changed their mind and put Luger with Stan. But Luger's a guy who in 1989 was fantastic. Probably the best heel in the business. And in 1990, he was a babyface, and he still had some juice to him.
And was having good matches.
Having really good matches, but Joe, I mean, he was just a totally different vibe from Luger.
Yeah, I think all those. Because he was still U.S. champion. He beat U.S. champ for like 18 months or something crazy like that. But yeah, a lot of steam was lost with those, not winning the title, at least even for a brief run, which, wouldn't have been optimal, but would have helped, I think, because fans just stopped believing in them, and yeah, it was just something wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. Now, also on television, they begin this angle for the Southern Tag Team title trophy between the Southern Boys, Steve Armstrong is the Fabulous Freebirds, and it's a really fun TV angle. It's only on television.
Well, it was only on the Freebirds version of the Pro, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was only on Pro. That's
so,
right.
No, but also, if you were in New York and Chicago or only got that version of the Pro, you did not see this angle.
That's the thing, yeah, because it was set up in commentary and other stuff. So you just got the matches, but you didn't understand why these matches were taking place. But it eventually culminated in the Buddy Roberts coming in and Bullet Bob Armstrong coming in. But Bix, talk about the Southern Boys got over really good, really quick, and then just fell apart as far as like a push.
Yeah, they came in, they had the matches with Midnight Express. They went on to this feud here. They kind of dragged this feud out till too long because the Freebirds weren't really doing anything, and then that was kind of it. And then they disappear for a few months, and suddenly they're from Wyoming, probably. Well, being from Wyoming wasn't for a good reason. Changing their outfits was probably for a good reason because they had the Confederate flag trunks and the Civil War uniform jackets.
I think Dusty just wanted guys from Wyoming. He wanted to create his young cowboys, I guess is what was.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So it was when Dusty came in was when the change happened?
Yes. Yeah.
So it wasn't about the Confederate stuff being offensive then?
No.
Oh, I always thought it was. Okay.
No, I thought it was just more of a Southern, not wanting to be as Southern.
Yeah, because you got to remember at this time, and Joe brings a good point about the Southern deal, as Ole was wanting to really, make this a Southern promotion again. He wanted to be more regional. He didn't want to go outside of the Southeast. And they kind of kept true to that in a lot of ways for about the next year, because you look at where the shows were, like their big shows. You had shows in Chattanooga, Savannah, Augusta, Charleston, South Carolina. A lot of your major clashes and pay-per-views were held in Southern towns. So that was actually a good idea, I think, on their part, was to downsize and go that, because that was their strongest markets. But yeah, the Young Pistols, I mean, it worked, but they were never the same after being the Southern Boys.
Well, the Young Pistols never felt like a high-level tag team. They felt like a prelim tag team. Just the act, the outfit, the name, everything. And they just didn't feel like they meant anything. The Southern Boys did. It's hard to put your finger on, whether it's the name or the outfits or whatever. They just, because it wasn't just the push. They still got a decent push at first.
Yeah.
It wasn't like they lost all their push. It's weird. But
they actually won the U.S. tag titles as the Young Pistols.
Yeah, as heels, right?
Yeah, as heels.
And they were really good as heels. Yeah, Tracy Smothers, that's when he found his calling. First time as a heel. And he was awesome. Doing the little Tracy Smothers dance, which he incorporated to the FBI and stuff like that. Yeah, they were awesome as heels. But, Joe, I want to talk about the Freebirds in this time period real quick. They were trying a lot of different things, too, as far as their look. And, oh, my God. Talk about the sequins and the eyeshadow mascara Freebirds.
Yeah, I think that's the look they first pulled out of the bash that year against the Steiners. And they were, looking very flamboyant there, which I don't think they had it that long. I think they kind of went back to the normal look pretty quickly, but
they kept it rest 1990 because they brought in Rocky King came in.
That's right. Oh yeah,
little Richard Marley.
But they didn't have have it at the end of the year. That like the year end show with Lance. They're the regular Freebirds.
Well, they would go back and forth.
Right. Yeah.
They still wore the eyeshadow though. They were wearing eyeshadow up until when they hooked up with DDP at WrestleMania.
Yeah.
They were still wearing an eyeshadow, but yeah, that was just a weird look, and Michael Hayes was really out of shape at this time period.
Yeah. I had no clue about this Southern Tag Trophy.
It was a very cool angle, and the Bob Armstrong stuff is awesome.
Yeah, the Freebirds, I'll go ahead.
Yeah, Bob Armstrong, of course, is awesome in every way imaginable, but he cut a promo that was fantastic on the Freebird. And, of course, they got Buddy Roberts in, and they did the clash match where all of them had the Confederate face paint. I mean, it's just great stuff.
And the Southern Tag Team Trophy, and correct me if I'm wrong, because, again, I didn't really see any of this, was that they had won. They showed up with a trophy claiming to have won a tournament that did not exist, right, the Freebirds?
Of course, it's wrestling.
Where was it? Because I remember the city was part of it.
I can't remember exactly what city it was because it's been forever since
It was somewhere in the Memphis territory, I think they said, right?
Yeah.
Wherever, it was a city that's in, like, maybe, I don't know where they said it was. And then, like, the whole thing is like, but that trophy's not real, and blah, 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 blah. But then the Southern boys start fighting them over it for some reason. But it's better than it sounds. And,
it's playing off the Freebirds deal from all year long. They were, their feuds they were in were revolved around their commentary on Pro, whether it was the gold record deal with the Rock and Roll Express where they break the gold record, or the concert tape from Germany that gets destroyed. I mean, yeah, the Freebirds, I mean, that was really fun, like self-contained stuff in the promotion.
I wish we got to see Charles and Lito wrestle. Can you imagine Charles and Lito wrestling a match without the commentary to explain it?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Joe, are you familiar with Charles and Lito?
I don't. I mean, need a reminder.
They go on this trip to Hollywood, and they show this video where they're mobbed by adoring fans
at CNN Center. Right. By the way,
oh, shot at CNN Center. Yeah, and then Lance Russell produces the tape, a secretly shot of them telling these actually paid fake fans what to do and how to react and acting all dismissive. So then the next week, the Freebirds say, no, no, no. We found the poor immigrants you hired to pretend us, and it's the Freebirds in a split screen talking to themselves in bad wigs as poor illegal immigrants named Charles and Lito, who were paid off by Lance Russell and the insurance man. and then there was this thing about, like, you know, that Lance Russell and the insurance man like young girls.
The NWA Pro was kind of like its own little separate deal.
And even before that, and Charles and Lito also hosted an episode of Pro, too.
Yeah.
Which I've never seen.
I mean, it was hilarious, and Lance was awesome in that whole role as a straight man for the Freebirds.
I mean, he was having the time of his life there. I mean, that was
underrated, very underrated. I wish more
because many people haven't seen it.
Yeah, because WWE Network. If anybody from WWE Network is listening, which
they're not
going to
show that. Did you see? Do you see the episode of Monday Night War? But that episode of Monday, I think it was Monday Night War, where they're talking about WCW being seen as a Southern promotion, and they show a clip like Lance and Bob Armstrong hosting Pro or something, and that is their evidence of WCW being this Southern promotion. Because it's like, what's the most Southern thing we can find? Oh, it's Lance Russell and Bob Armstrong hosting a show together.
That is pretty Southern, though.
It's awesomely Southern.
It's awesomely Southern. That's damn right. Well, something that's not Southern in the slightest way, and we're going to close the show with this funny little story, We talked about him a while ago. Is El Gigante. El Gigante had just really started the Bash pay-per-view, and he was totally clueless in a lot of ways. Well, they had a battle royal in Pittsburgh on August 3rd, and they were trying to explain to El Gigante what his role in this would be about. And basically, he had never seen a battle royal, much less participated in one, so he was having a hard time grasping what they were telling him to do. So they eventually basically told him, well, just stand there like a statue throughout the match and just wait for the finish, which is what he did. He just and they said, and the reports were to show that all these guys were in the ring fighting each other, and El Gigante was standing in the corner all by himself, and nobody went over there to him. And then eventually, the last two men in the ring were Eaton and Lane, the Midnight Express, and then he comes up behind them and pushes them over the top rope, and that's how he wins the Battle Royal.
God bless him.
Now, El Gigante, Joe, I mean, his tremendous look as far as his size, big guy, but one of the worst wrestlers ever.
Yeah, he was in a ton of Battle Royals when he first started. I don't know if it was like trying to break Andre's record. I don't know if that was just something in the aftermath.
Well, it's something you can have him do where he can look impressive. And
sure.
Yeah,
he had the one on the Clash and all that. So I'm glad
he remember. I don't even remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like 91.
Yeah, that was the Knoxville one.
Yeah. Knoxville, USA, that one?
Yeah, I think that was that one. Yeah, it was one of those. But yeah, I mean, El Gigante, I mean, yeah, it was a big deal, too, that he was in there. But and hell, they put him with Flair in 91, I mean, for world title matches. So they were trying their best to get him over, but it just, I mean, he had fans, but it was not Andre. It was far from it. Because Andre could actually work. When he was healthy, when he was younger.
Even when he wasn't healthy, he still knew how to work.
Yeah, he worked smarter, but yeah, it was a totally different deal. Well, on that note, we're going to close this show. And first off, though, we'll give the plugs. Joe, what have you got going on right now?
Oh, man, the weekly Wrestling Podmask column where I listen to all the wrestling podcasts and review them, so you don't have to. You can pick and choose. At Voices of Wrestling every Friday, there was a new one up. I'm not sure when this drops, but
this drops Monday.
Okay, so
yeah, we go every Monday. We have new shows.
All right, so yep, every Friday that'll come up. I do my podcast Joe versus the World still every now and then, not that often. And my
legendary podcast Joe.
Oh, thank you, and my YouTube series, The Funtime Arcade, and in a few weeks, Wrestle Geek Fest in Cleveland, Ohio. I will be there hosting panels. Video game tournaments, all the like. So come say hi. Give me a high five.
That sounds awesome. And yeah, the Podmask thread is, you know, Joe does yeoman service listening to some of these podcasts that can god awful and keep us from having to waste our time listening to it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, especially shows like Talking Shop. And I love Doc Gallows, but wow. Some of those shows can be woof. But anyway, Bix. What are your most important plugs of the week?
Okay, so let's see. Out already as we record this, new issue of Figure Four Weekly, which is free for this week, because I want to, you know, we've been thinking about doing another free issue for a while. Figured this is a good week to do it. Very, very detailed look at the latest stuff in the Hogan, the Gawker FBI lawsuit as it pertains to Hogan, which turned out to be filed the same day as all the Hogan stuff came out, and, now that we know that, a lot of interesting stuff about why that illuminates as to why Gawker thinks the FBI helped Hogan cover up the what seems now to be the racist rant and all that. Then also, I guess, so it's a couple days after this drops, New Fighting Spirit magazine coming out that shows up, you know, in the app and all that at midnight Eastern time on Wednesday night, Thursday morning. I have a big article on a 20th anniversary of the debut of Monday Nitro, with quotes from Eric Bischoff and Scott Norton, who I interviewed. And also, I have part of an interview with Ricky Steamboat in the training ground section, where he talks a lot about selling and laying out a match. And it is awesome stuff, whether you are a fan or if you're, especially if you're a wrestler, though, read this. It is awesome. It's, like, amazing. Like, Steamboat is a genius. He is better than anyone I have ever heard at communicating this stuff. in just a simple way too. And you know, also WrestlingInc.com, Today in Wrestling History every day, wrestling podcast every week, and I guess that's good for now. And you know, yeah, you know the rest. And Twitter at David Bix.
Yeah, and at Joe Gagne on Twitter for Joe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Exile, the last episode of Exile on Bass Street dropped earlier today. We're talking about Memphis, the most known unknown, hat tip to the 3-6 Mafia. Yeah, I mean, we talk about – it's a Memphis show where we don't talk about – focus on Lawler and Dundee, but we talk a lot about Lawler and Dundee. But basically, we're talking about guys like Dream Machine and Jimmy Valiant and Tommy Rich, Austin Idol, The Fabs, and Coco Ware. I mean, that's who we talk about in this show. And it's with good old Will from Texas and Phil Schneider making his first appearance on the show. And it's not a marathon show. I tried to keep it that way, mainly because I want to do more of those shows. So I didn't want to, you know, blow the load on the first show, but it's a great show, man. We have a blast just talking about, you know, this, what the great Memphis stuff. And yeah, this show, of course, the Between the Sheets drops every Monday. We haven't decided yet on the next week's guest or which week we're going, I mean, which year we're going to talk about, but that will be discussed soon. By the time you listen to this, I'm pretty sure that the Roddy Piper show will be done that we're going to do. Replace B Nation, and which is going to probably tape Saturday. And I got a very special episode of Exile on Bass Street coming up that will probably drop after this show drops, regarding the Scenic City Invitational with our buddy Dylan Hales and some special guests, which I won't talk about yet. And yeah, just a lot of audio going on, man. A lot of audio. So, and a lot more, you know, planned for the future. So, yeah. It's been a great show, guys, and Joe, definitely want to have you back on in the future.
Sure.
And you know, as we get along later in the years, we're going to have a lot more interesting stuff to talk about as well. So for Joe and for Bix, this is Chris saying so long from the Peach State of Georgia.